Good Thursday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad you've joined us today. We've got a very busy show for you. Jim Garrity from National Review going to be with us momentarily. Also later in the hour, our friend Brian Lilly with Beyond the News, talking about what's going on in Canada, where there are now more than a million restricted and prohibited firearms registered. That number is going up, by the way, which shouldn't happen when things are restricted and prohibited, but it is. So we'll talk about what's actually taking place there in Canada. Also next hour, Tim Graham of the Media Research Center talking about that poll. It was a Harvard-Harris poll. We mentioned it on yesterday's program. A majority of Americans, about 66% of Americans, say the media is pumping out fake news. That would include a majority of Republican respondents, independents, and even a majority of Democrat respondents. So Tim Graham on that next hour. Also Rhonda Ezell from Chicago Guns Matter on the possibility that we may see a range one day, relatively soon, in the city of Chicago. Now that the city has changed its rules regarding ranges once again, I wish I could say I was cautiously optimistic. I'm not. I'm cautiously cynical that we'll see a range in Chicago sometime soon, because there are still some details and some ways for the city to drag its feet and to delay or to deny any prospective ranges that might try to open up in the city. But we'll talk about that with Rhonda. Maybe she'll give me room for some optimism next hour. Also, Dan Bongino with Conservative Review. A whistleblower saying that the Obama administration knew that gang members, part of the surge in illegal immigration into the United States. We'll talk with Dan about that in hour three. Also, our hero of the day, our deal of the day, good guy. We've got updates from the opioid epidemic around the country. But right now, let's welcome in our friend Jim Garrity from National Review. How are you, Jim?
Hi, Cam. How you doing?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program today. I'll tell you what, though. This is I was doing my daily news scan, and I'd forgotten about some of the big stories from yesterday. So you just look around the world right now. You've got a protest in Brazil yesterday. The military called out to protect government buildings in the Brazilian capital. Buildings set on fire. Apparently the troops were withdrawn today, but there's still a great deal of turmoil. Venezuela, that kind of pushed Venezuela off the headlines, but there are still protests taking place in Venezuela today. Then you have in the Philippines a ISIS-inspired group that's taken over a town, apparently. And the first reports of that, Jim, it seemed like, you know, this was maybe, you know, some sort of operation to take the leader of this group in, and there was a gun battle. No, I mean, it really does sound like now you've got parts of this town taken over by terrorists in the Philippines. Then you've got the latest revelations on the attack in Manchester, England, that we'll talk about. It just seems like this has been a crazy week.
It has been, and this is after the previous week where it felt like every right around closing time, there was some sort of earth-shattering revelation coming out of Washington. I think you're right. I think when the entire media and press world gets into – last week when you were in studio and we were able to chat, we talked about how the mentality of the media is to rerun Watergate, right? That if you just keep digging, you just keep exposing enough stories about the president, eventually it leads to impeachment. You get to mount his head on your wall, and Robert Redford plays you in the movie. Part of the problem with this is the Trump obsession of the American media, which, look, you know, he's president. He's making big changes. He's got a very different approach to how he's doing things. His mouth gets him in trouble. Yes, the president is going to generate a lot of news on any given day. Having said that, there are things in this world that are going on that are, you know, every bit as consequential and important. And, you know, the American news media, the American news audience may not always want to hear about it, but sometimes this stuff really is darn important. Like, as you said, that that, you know, quasi takeover of a town by ISIS. ISIS is a, you know, the sort of threat that that threatens, you know, dozens and dozens of countries, not just us in the United States or United Kingdom. And it's, you know, worth keeping an eye on that and getting a sense of just how the scale of the problem there. I think at times the, you know, listen, to the extent Americans have heard anything about the Philippines in the last 2 or 3 months, mm-hmm. it probably is about their president. And probably the biggest news on the American front was the Trump phone call to the president, which, you know, do I agree with the things Trump has said? No, it sounds like he's kind of really turning a blind eye to President Duterte's rougher around the edges, shall we say, approach to dealing with the drug threats, things that I think would make any civil libertarian tear their hair out. But, you know, those things are important outside of the context of, oh, my goodness, can you imagine, you know, can you believe Trump said this?
Well, yeah, there, and you know, it's kind of fascinating too, because we have seen a lot of media coverage of the attack in Manchester. I would say far more coverage of the terror attack in Manchester than what's going on in it's not Malawi. I don't maybe it is Malawi. That's the name of the Philippine city. But you know, you've had Duterte has declared martial law. For Mindanao, 22 million Filipinos now living under martial law. You've got people held hostage in a Catholic church by some of these individuals. Like, it's kind of amazing to me that that story actually hasn't gotten more attention, because it's still an unfolding situation. And it's not really front page news. It's not really a leading or really even a part of the news cycle on the cable news networks right now.
That is a fair assessment, and I think a fair criticism there, Cam. I also would point out that, like, look, on the one hand, the Manchester bombing is indisputably huge news. This is the sort of thing you interrupt your live coverage of. This is something that deserves in-depth coverage, and that most, you know, the most Americans want to know about and that they ought to know about. But I can't help but have a sneaking suspicion that the involvement of a celebrity like Ariana Grande, I don't know whether that is a factor or whether it's something that Americans can relate to, whether or not they're much more likely to have been to the United Kingdom than they are to have been to the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of going to a big arena in a downtown city to watch a concert is something that Americans may relate to more than going to church in a small town somewhere out in the outer islands of the Philippines. You know, it's a little bit of a cultural bias there. Now, again, by no means am I saying that Manchester is being overcovered. It is something that does deserve this coverage. And I think, I don't know about you, Ken, and maybe you've talked this to death earlier in the week, but it does feel like when you have an event that involves so many children, so many families being deliberately targeted by some guy who apparently was over in Libya and apparently was either may have had ties to both al-Qaeda and ISIS at various points, or who very much was on the government's watch list. Well, this really should outrage us. This should outrage us as much as the Beslan school massacre back in 2003, 2004 did. It feels like every time you feel like ISIS and the maniacs in that group have hit bottom and crossed every moral threshold, they find some new way to do it. And I'm sure there are a lot of parents across the country, really around the world, saying, you know, dear God, that could have been my kids. Going to a concert like that.
Absolutely. Our friend Kurt Schlichter, I think, had a pretty good column at Town Hall today on that, talking about it's okay to be angry. You should be angry when you watch and you think about what happened. It's entirely proper to be angry and to not want a hashtag and to not want to, you know, hold hands and sing Kumbaya. Because that is, and again, Jim, that's also, you know, you're told you shouldn't be angry about this, right? You should feel bad for the misunderstood guy who did such a horrible thing. But you shouldn't be angry, because, you know, that leads to retribution or that leads to revenge, and we don't want anything like that. So don't be angry about this. And it is okay to be angry when you look at these lives that have been lost, when you look at the children who will never get to grow up, the families who will always be grieving for the rest of their lives. We're allowed to be angry about that.
Oh, absolutely. And what's more, I think we have a couple of different directions to steer our anger this time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, if you get so angry that you're going to try to, you know, set fire to your local mosque or something like that, then okay, dial it back. Right? Don't go out and take it out on somebody who has nothing to do with this. But it sounds like, from the media reports we're getting over in the UK, that the local imam of the Manchester mosque had preached against ISIS, and in fact, the bomber was one of the guys who came up to him afterwards and apparently strongly disagreed with that. And it sounds, you know, it sounds like more than a few people in that mosque and in that community had already reported this guy. And I try not to unfairly slam law enforcement and intelligence agencies. I know that they have an enormously difficult task. I realize that it takes an enormous amount of manpower to do round-the-clock surveillance of somebody who you think is a dangerous extremist and could be planning some sort of attack or something like that. But look, if there are hundreds or thousands of people in the United Kingdom that need round-the-clock surveillance, then the United Kingdom needs to have an honest discussion of that. Don't pretend that it's a few dozen. If it really is that, you know, it really is a scale on that sort of threat.
Right.
Clearly, for a long time, if you ride the D.C. Metro, if you see something, say something. You hear it at every airport. Well, it sounds like in this case, people did say something. We had a spate of this with several mass shooters a couple of years ago. That there were plenty of red flags. Plenty of people were reporting them. Plenty of people were mentioning it to employers, to university administrators. Psychologists were referring things to cops. I mean, one of the things I earlier in the week I'd written about the wonderful performer Katy Perry, who had offered, I think she meant to give the standard boilerplate response after a terrible event like this, and to say we all needed unity and love and coexistence. And my point was, look, if there were 20,000 people surrounding that bomb the other night, then 19,999 of them had no problem with peace and unity,
right,
and love and coexistence. It was one guy, right? And if anything, you can look at Manchester and you can look at the sheer number of people who opened up their homes to people who needed to stay someplace for the night. The fact that the blood banks had, you know, were up to capacity. Overnight, they raised $1 million to help the families. Look, the problem is not societal. The problem is not that we are not a good and wonderful, decent people over there in the United Kingdom, here in the United States, and in most communities around the world. The problem is the perpetrators. And there's no action that we can take that will dissuade them, that this is not a rational argument we're having with them of, oh, if we're just nicer to them, they won't do this. They do this, you know, out of a complicated series of internal psychological motives, usually a good portion of insecurity, rage at the world, a sense of, you know, both psychic and psychological and perhaps even physical impotence. An inability to actually, you know, do anything with their lives, and they want to hurt other people in order to kind of balance the scales in their mind. There's no amount of love or compassion that's going to change that. They get this from a twisted version of their religious beliefs, and they decide, well, by golly, this is what I'm going to get my eternal reward after I die by doing something like this. You know, so I got irritated with the Katy Perry comment. And look, I'm not expecting, you know, brilliant counterterrorism strategies from the likes of Katy Perry. And I know she probably had the very best of intentions, but it did kind of tend up with this attitude of, oh, if we're just nicer to people, these sorts of things won't happen. No, why? The reason this happened has nothing to do with us. It has everything to do with their decisions and their twisted, you know, viewpoint of this. And unfortunately, it requires counterintelligence officials and law enforcement and intelligence world and places like that to be more in intervene with these guys before they do something like this.
Well,
you know, a tall order in the best of circumstances, but clearly it's not, you know, the task is not being done at the level it needs to be done if we're having events like this.
So you bring up Katy Perry, I will bring up Morrissey, and this will be
right?
one of the
yeah.
weirdest conversations that you and I have ever had. But first of all,
what people expected when they tuned in today.
Exactly, right. First of all, I think it was the Independent newspaper I saw that in England that said that five times over the past 2 years, this guy had been on the radar. Somebody had said something, you know, they had seen something and they had said something five different times. And so that does raise the question of, okay, well, if you see something and you say something, you're supposed to then do something, right? And what is being done when we see something, and when we say something? But, you know, Morrissey had a post on his Facebook page, I think it was afterwards, and, you know, very raw, it was not your standard, let's give each other a hug and have a Pepsi and we'll all be good. You know, he said, look, we need to talk about this. We need to talk about the fact that, we've got people in this country who are trying to kill us. We don't really want to talk about this. We don't really want to talk about, immigration. We don't really want to talk about, the number of people who have come back from Syria after having fought there. And again, you know, as you brought out, we don't really know, Jim, how big a pool we're talking about here, right? So how can we have an honest discussion when I think in many cases a lot of us feel like we're not the government doesn't feel like we're entitled to the facts, enough of the facts to have a real conversation about what's going on?
Yeah, well, look, on the one hand, I completely understand the viewpoint of, say, MI5 or our FBI to say, look, We're not going to tell you exactly what criteria we use to put someone under around-the-clock surveillance, because then the aspiring terrorists will then say, okay, well, let's not do that. On the other hand, it does seem like a lot of these guys are on the watch list, and they should have been on the let's do something about them list. And kind of a sense of we have this nagging feeling that, you know, you hear somebody say something very extreme, you hear somebody behaving strangely or other things that make you think this guy might be a threat to others. You report it to law enforcement, and maybe law enforcement sets up a file on the guy, and then it goes into the file cabinet, and nothing happens. And you're kind of like, well, you know, earlier this week I'd written about, you saw people talking about, apparently here in the United States, you're going to see more metal detectors at concerts, more security barriers and things like that. And I realize everyone involved in these sorts of things has the best of intentions and is trying to make the world safer, but we should be honest with ourselves. A security line, a metal detector, is not actually going to stop a suicide bomber. If anything, you know, anybody who's been to one of these big events understands that metal detectors tend to create lines.
Mm-hmm.
Lines create crowds, which is exactly what a suicide bomber wants. They just want a lot of people in one space. So if they can't get past the security checkpoint, they'll just blow themselves up on the outside side of the security checkpoint. This is not a problem we can really security barrier our way out of. So I kind of think we need a slightly more honest discussion of these sorts of things. The only thing that can really stop a suicide bomber, once they've built their bomb and once they're trying to, you know, go off and do, you know, create some mayhem, is to, you know, once they've got the bomb strapped on them, it's almost game over. Like maybe if you're lucky, you can stop them before they get to a crowd. But in all likelihood, you need to intervene before then. You have to intervene at some point, you know, either assembling the bomb or, you know, trying to get the parts for the bomb. And we have seen people arrested by the FBI, by undercover agents and things like that. So I know they're trying hard. I know this is not a matter of the government being completely lackadaisical. But clearly it feels like the resources are not equal to the threat, and you're kind of left scratching your head. You know, gee whiz, if this isn't your top priority to stop, what is?
Talking again with Jim Garrity from National Review. So, Jim, Politico had a story today. I don't know if you saw this or not. The issue that Democrats wish would go away. Do you know what issue that might be?
Anything policy-oriented that doesn't involve Trump? Anything that's not a Trump scandal?
Gun control. The issue Democrats wish would go away. Can the Democratic Party retake Congress by giving up on gun control? Should it? Wonders Bill Scheer. This piece, by the way, has already been subject to a scathing rebuttal by Media Matters that, no, of course they shouldn't give up gun control. But yeah, it is interesting. And we've talked about this. I think you and I have talked about this before. Bill Scheer points out that, in a lot of these special elections, Democrats have been running, as, you know, pro-gun Democrats. You had the, Kansas candidate, shooting an AR. In one of his campaign ads, and Rob Quist using a lever action rifle to blast away at a TV in Montana. And John Ossoff, Scheer points out, hasn't really said much at all about the gun issue, although he did come out in opposition to campus carry in Georgia. But very much playing up their pro-gun bona fides. Now, part of that, I think, is where these elections have been taking place. In Virginia, know the Democratic candidates for governor are trying to out anti-gun one another. But it's fascinating that he goes back and he talks about the rise of the Blue Dog Democrats, the demise of the Blue Dog Democrats when they were, you know, forced to vote like Nancy Pelosi on gun control as opposed to vote the wishes of their constituency. But asking that question, would Democrats be better off if they dropped their need or their desire for gun control?
Politically, yes. And I think you can point to the 2006 election and the election of likes of, you know, to the Heath Shulers of the world in places like North Carolina as a good example of when, you know, Democrats are willing to be flexible on some of these, cultural issues that are very resonant and in what is traditionally deep red parts of the country, then, yeah, you can pick up votes you otherwise would not. The problem is that, One, I don't know if Nancy Pelosi grasps that. I think she certainly, if she understands it, she wishes it were not true and is not really willing to play ball with that sort of situation. She is not really willing to give much ground on that and generally makes these people make votes, take votes that will hurt them back home. And the second thing is that, as much as we enjoy laughing at the folks at Media Matters, I can't begrudge them this sense of saying that, no, the Democrats can't do that because if they did, well, where would the gun control, where would Americans support gun control go? They would be a, they would be a movement without a party. And, you know, I'm sure in some eyes they kind of feel like they already are, because there certainly are Democrats who don't want to, who either, you know, don't agree with them, the Jim Webbs of the world say, or they don't want to overtly agree with them, and want to downplay the issue as much as possible. But you and I know that, you know, deep down, you look at Hillary Clinton, you look at Chuck Schumer, you look at just about any, you know, deep blue Democrat. To them, ultimately, Heller was wrongly decided. There is no individual right to own a firearm. And, you know, every time there's a mass shooting, their first thought is, well, we're going to pass the gun control bill and that'll solve the problem. Deep down, they don't think American people should be trusted with something like that. They deep down, they're not convinced that this is a good idea. They think the Second Amendment was some sort of oversight or glaring mistake. And if they could repeal it, they would. But that's really difficult and hard. And they know they don't know, they don't know the votes. So they just want to ignore it. And that's a philosophy that I think, you know, as long as the Democrats hold to that philosophy, they'll have a very hard time winning in places. You know, never mind the North, you know, the Georgias and the Montanas of the world. I think the North Carolinas, I think the upper Midwest, I think there are a lot of states that are very, very tough to win if you are too overtly pro-gun control.
I think that you're right. And there was an angle that Bill Scheer didn't get into. And that is, I think that there's also a bit of a conflict. And I think you and I have talked about this before, for progressives, who want to support more gun laws, but at the same time feel like our criminal justice system is really messed up and is in need of desperate reform. Right. And is systemically and inherently biased against minorities. Boy, it's really hard at the same time, Jim, to call for more laws to be put on the books that are going to put more people in prison, right? That'll be disproportionately used against young men of color, for instance. I think that there's a real a conundrum there for Democrats who are willing to confront that. And I think that a lot of them aren't. I think a lot of them are willing to just, you know, not talk about that conflict that's inherent in those two positions. But sooner or later, you're going to have to deal with it. In fact, they're dealing with it right now in Illinois. There was a bill that I think would increase the penalties for people who were convicted a second time of a violent offense with a firearm. And there were some Democrats who did not want to vote for this, saying, you know, I'm going to get grief for this back home. And there were some Democrats who said, yeah, you know, we need to do something to target the violence. And they were, again, legislatively sort of dancing around the issue, but it's a real issue for the party.
It is. And I think, you know, every once in a while you'll hear people lamenting, oh, it's politics. They're always bickering. It's always the same. Nothing ever changes. This perception that the sides in politics have hardened and calcified and there's no real change or dynamism to it. Well, actually, I think there is. I think, you know, you can point to the election of a guy who's probably better classified as a populist as the Republican president of the United States is Exhibit A. But maybe Exhibit B would be that issue you point to, criminal justice reform, where you saw a lot of Republicans and a lot of voices, the likes of the Texas Public Policy Foundation and the Koch Seminar Network, who really kind of looked at the criminal justice system and this law and order approach that had been very popular in Republican circles since the 1980s, 1990s, you know, lock them up and throw away the key. Or maybe even going further back to Richard Nixon, this concept of, you know, the Republicans being the law and order party. Yes, it's still there in President Trump, and I think the attitude of Jeff Sessions in general, but there were a lot of Republican governors. Chris Christie, Scott Walker, Rick Perry also kind of looked at it and said, you know, you do the crime, you do the time, we put you in jail, and then what? When you come out, what do we want to do with you? At some point, you need these people to be able to restart their lives, and we want to figure out how do we best get these people into a job, into a stable environment, into a situation where they can go back to being productive members of society. Because, look, yes, we have a lot of foolish young people in this society. Yes, we have a lot of people who will do dumb things and commit crimes in their teens, early 20s, but we don't want to, you know, wreck the rest of their lives. We want to give them a path to redemption if they're willing to do the right thing. And if you're going to criminalize as many things associated with gun ownership as possible, you're going to end up in a situation where you are going in the opposite direction, which you are more likely to have people with three strikes and they're out. You're going to have more people in which you end up having more young people, and particularly young males, running into situations in which they've run afoul of the law and they now have something on their record that will follow them the rest of their lives and you know, potentially derail them from a life that didn't have to go so wrong. So yeah, there's a contradiction there, but, you know, look, Cam, people in politics are never really all that great at recognizing contradictions, are they?
No, that's a fair point. All right, Jim, listen, we got to take a break, but thank you, as always, for coming on the program. It's good talking with you today.
Always enjoy it, Cam. Look forward to when our paths cross next.
Me too. Jim Garrity from National Review with us on the program. We're going to take a quick time out, be back with more of the day's top stories. Brian Lilly from Beyond the News coming up a little bit later on in the hour as well, so stick around. Much more Cam and Company on the way. Talking with Ron Sasaki from AmericanSnipers.org. In case people haven't ever heard of AmericanSnipers.org, what is the mission of this group?
Okay, what our mission is we help equip our military snipers. If they have any equipment needs when they're getting deployed, if they can't get equipment through their normal chain of command, they get a hold of us, and we gift that gear to them. No cost to them. We operate solely on donations. We're 100% nonprofit, all-volunteer organization. So we're just trying to help these guys out as they're going downrange.
And this is really, I think, a brotherhood that got started here. I mean, you've got a law enforcement, military members who were instrumental, I mean, in putting this together. This started with one guy helping one guy, and it kind of snowballed from there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it started, most of us have a law enforcement background. We're all current or former SWAT snipers. So in the early 2000s, we had some of our brother snipers getting deployed in various units. And they found out there was an equipment shortage at that time. So they asked for some gear, and it got donated, and then it just kind of snowballed from there. So we've been going strong ever since. You know, kind of slowed down with the units getting deployed over the last few years, but of course things are starting to ramp back up again.
Absolutely. And you know, you talk about the slowdown, but it never really disappears because, you know, a lot of these guys are they're kind of operating in the shadows. They're not operating in the theaters where we see a lot of headlines about combat. Some of these missions are taking place in places where we don't necessarily even think about guys being on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. And because it hasn't been on the headlines, people kind of forget about them. And then, you know, so their budgets shrink, too. So we are still supporting some of those guys, even some of the, you know, the bigger units that are doing a lot of work overseas. So we've got a lot of equipment that's been going out. So, you know, all the donations and being able to be here at the NRA show has been great. That really helps out a lot.
That's fantastic. And just give me an example of like some of the type of equipment that you will provide these guys. What are they not getting?
Well, it's mostly sniper-specific equipment that we provide. So it's a lot of binoculars, range finders, spotting scopes, the Kestrel wind meters, a lot of those things that the guys ask for that they have a tough time getting through their normal chain of command. We operate solely on donations. So if you can go to AmericanSnipers.org, you can donate there, or you can buy some of our T-shirts and hats and challenge coins, and that's what helps us out.
Here at the NRA annual meeting, not too far away from the NRA Country Soundstage. You might hear some music in the background. And this is music to gun owners' ears right here. This is a firearms-friendly credit card processing. Eric, where have you been all our lives?
We've actually been with the NRA for quite a while, so maybe we're not doing a good enough job of getting the message out there. So apologies there. So
we hear more and more, though, about firearm companies, whether they're gun stores, they make accessories, they don't even make firearms, but all of a sudden, now they're being told by their bank, sorry, we don't want to do business with you anymore. No, we don't want to have anything to do with you. Whether it's the money going in or the money being processed,
right.
The industry is, you know, they're definitely dealing with this, and you guys are a solution.
Absolutely, absolutely. The industry suffered from what was called Operation Choke Point for a while, where it was federal regulations on banking and credit card processing. So what we do is we provide 100% firearm-friendly credit card processing, and we educate folks how to take payment for a firearm lawfully and correctly, and also save money and support the NRA in the process.
Okay, so are you for the business, are you for the consumer, or are you for both?
Both. We provide business services, so anyone who's taking a payment for a merchant, you know, credit card, as far as a firearm piece, we would provide that service for them.
Okay, fantastic. And is the company growing? I mean, is this...
Absolutely, absolutely. We have 45,000 merchants currently on the books. I believe 20,000 of them are with the NRA presently. So it's growing every day. We have a great retention rate. Folks stay with us, and the endorsement of the NRA as well as other organizations in the firearm space help that as well.
All right, so how can folks find out more about Clearant?
They can go to Clearant's website at www.clearant.com, or they can go to the NRABA.org, and underneath the member services section, you'll find us listed there as well.
Awesome. Again, part of the NRA Business Alliance, Clearant Intelligent Processing. Welcome back to Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Coming up about an hour from now, a little bit less, Tim Graham of the Media Research Center on the mainstream media. New poll out, Harris-Harvard poll, showing a majority of Americans, pretty stunning majority, something like two-thirds of Americans, believe that the mainstream media publishes fake news on a fairly regular basis. Plus, Rhonda Ezell will join us next hour as well. We've got Brian Lilly on the way. And in the pages of the L.A. Times, fascinating op-ed today. Keep concealed guns out of California. Mike Feuer and Charlie Beck, the authors of this op-ed in the L.A. Times. Mike Feuer, the city attorney for L.A. Charlie Beck is the chief of police for the Los Angeles Police Department. And it's not quite what you'd think with the headline, Keep Concealed Carry Out of California. The pair write, Californians have a lot on the line in the next congressional debate about America's gun laws. Two bills stacked with legislative sponsors, House Bill 38 in the House, Senate Bill 446 in the Senate, would override, they say, our state's longstanding rules governing who is allowed to carry a concealed loaded firearm in public. These bills, they say, both called the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act, would dictate that if a person can carry a concealed weapon in any state, that person could carry it everywhere in America. This, they say, should be a call to action for all Californians concerned about keeping their families safe. Yeah, concealed carry reciprocity. 12 states, they say, do not require any permit to carry hidden loaded guns within their borders. That would be the constitutional carry states, all of which still have concealed carry licenses, all of them. And as a matter of fact, in order to have reciprocity with another state, one would have to have a concealed carry license. Not that the city attorney for L.A. or the chief of police for L.A. want their audience to know this, because they neglect to tell their audience this. Some states' rules, they say, have been so ineffective as to allow felons to carry concealed weapons. Not so in California. Our laws require good cause for the issuance of a concealed weapon permit. Applicants must undergo a comprehensive background check. No one with a serious criminal conviction may receive a permit, nor may subjects of temporary or permanent domestic violence restraining orders. But, they say, if concealed carry reciprocity were the law of the land, all this would change. Unbelievably, they say, the House version would allow an individual denied a permit in California to cross the border to a more permissive state, obtain a permit there, and then return to California with a new right to carry here. In other words, two different standards would be used. But here's the thing. In California, there already are two different standards being used right now. You know, a person living in Los Angeles County, applying to the L.A. County Sheriff for a concealed carry license for the purposes of self-defense is going to get turned down. They're going to be told no. They're not going to get a concealed carry license. Same if they live in San Francisco County. Same if they live in San Diego, California. There are some counties where self-defense is not seen as a valid reason to get a concealed carry license. There are other counties in which self-defense is viewed by the issuing authority as a valid reason to obtain a concealed carry license. So if you live in San Francisco County, you're hosed. If you live in Sacramento County, you're good. If you live in L.A., you're not going to get one. If you live in San Bernardino, you will. You'll have to wait because the demand is so high, but you will ultimately be able to get one if you can lawfully carry or lawfully possess a firearm in the state of California. There is already a two-tier system in the state of California right now. And again, the city attorney for Los Angeles, the chief of police for LA, don't want to recognize this. They don't want to acknowledge this. Because if they did acknowledge this, if they acknowledge that there's already this two-tier system in place in the state of California, they would then have to explain to their constituents and their residents why it is that they don't have a right that people in Sacramento County do, that they can't exercise the same right that residents in San Bernardino can. Are the people of L.A. inherently less trustworthy than the people of Sacramento or San Bernardino? I doubt it. It's just that the authorities have the discretion in California to decide, again, who has good cause and what is good cause. And in these coastal counties, self-defense isn't seen as good cause. Clearly it is seen as good cause in many counties across California and in most states across this country. It's not that L.A. is the leader here. They're the outlier, along with a handful of other states around the country. Hawaii, where, to the best of my knowledge, they've never issued a concealed carry license to a civilian. Employees, I believe, of the Honolulu Police Department have, on occasion, received a concealed carry license. Maryland, where, again, self-defense not seen as a valid reason to carry. New Jersey, New York City. There are a handful of places around the country where, no, your right to bear arms is not seen as a right. I would note again that California's provisions are being challenged in court, which is, again, something else that the chief and the city attorney don't really get into, don't want to get into. Look, it's an op-ed for the LA Times. They've only got a finite amount of space there. But you maybe should point out that there have been some judges there in the Ninth Circuit that have found that the way L.A. and San Diego and San Francisco issue or don't issue their concealed carry licenses isn't just problematic. It's an infringement on the constitutional rights of the residents who live in these places. Instead, get a lot of double talk and no recognition of the double standard that exists already in California. All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. When we return, Brian Lilly from Beyond the News talking about the number of prohibited and restricted guns in Canada. They're going up, which isn't supposed to happen when we're talking about guns that are prohibited and restricted, but clearly something's happening in Canada. So we'll get to the bottom of it with Brian Lilly. Stick around. Much more Cam and Company on the way right after this.
Here with our friend Ron Bellin from Reaper Outdoors. We've seen anti-hunting activists go out and attack everything from prairie dog hunts, hunting in Africa. Yeah. You know, you hunt hogs with knives and dogs. I can only imagine what PETA and HSUS would say if they heard about how you hunt.
Oh, they like us. They love us because then they have a job, because then they have something to complain about, which is the most primitive hunting in the world. Anti-hunters will complain about us using AR platforms because it's unfair. And then when you go chasing them like they did before guns were even invented and use knives, they'll complain about that. So they're just going to complain. They're just always going to be that type of person. And that's what's so cool about being here and being surrounded by like-minded people like you and myself. And, you know, if it's not for hunters, hunters are the largest conservation force out there today. They really are. If you want to talk environmentalists and take care of the environment, that's what hunters do. They pick up the trash. They thin the herd, if you will. They eat the meat that they kill. And the most organic meat on the planet is wild animals. So the complaints that we get, we are fighting it. We fight it up in Maine every year with the anti-baiting, anti-dog for bear hunting because they don't understand hunting, period. And also even dogs used for deer in the south. Southeast, it is a little different, but these clubs do a really good job. These are dogs that are trained to do what they do. The hog dogs take care of themselves, take care of the trainers, take care of them and the owners like you wouldn't believe. They care more for them than they do their families. I'm telling you, they get treated really well.
You know, and it's funny, you talk about how it doesn't matter what the tool is, right? The anti-hunters, they don't like hunting. That's what they're opposed to. It's not that they're opposed to hunting with an AR or hunting with a shotgun or hunting with right. a knife. They're opposed to you hunting. And yet, I mean, this is in your blood, Ron. You grew up hunting in Pennsylvania. You hunted to eat growing up. I mean, this is a part of who you are.
That's how we survived. We literally grew up with nothing. When I was born, my father looked at a map and he found out where the least amount of population was in Pennsylvania. And him and my mother bought 4 acres, borrowed the money from my grandparents, bought 4 acres, built a little log cabin, no running water, no electricity, and we had to pump water. Eventually, we did get a well to pump out because we had no electricity for a pump. And we used to get water from the stream. We lived in Alaska, dirt floor, one-room log cabin, and we gold mined up there, and no electricity, no running water, outhouse, and we lived off the land. And that's the thing, you bring up a great point with The anti-hunters will go to a store and they'll buy prepackaged meat, no matter what it is. And they'll come, they'll bring it home and feed their kids the steroid injected whatever. I eat meat from the fridge as well. But a hunter will go out and eat the most organic. I keep going back to that. The most primordial thing is to go eat your own food. And there's nothing better or more satisfying than actually going out and getting your own food, packaging it, storing it, and feeding your friends and family.
Absolutely. Even in this day and age where, again, it's easy to go down to the grocery store and, you know, pick up a package of chicken or a package of beef or whatever. But to know that if you needed to, that you didn't need the grocery store, to prove to yourself that, yes, I can go out and I can do this. I mean, that feeling that you get inside, it's tapping into something that's primal. It's tapping into something that, you know, goes back as long as mankind has been around. We've been hunting. And so to be able to tap into that experience, I think is amazing.
It is, and it's satisfaction. Every time I make a meal at my house, it's satisfaction. I have three freezers because we do a lot of hunting, obviously. But we, my friends come over, and we have converted people that didn't even eat meat because they didn't want to eat steroid injected or whatever, and antibiotic injected animals. But then they come over and they eat wild bear. Like, wow. They'll eat wild boar. They'll eat. So now they're eating wild animal meat. The other thing we didn't touch on, but is there's a season for these animals. So it's not like hunters are going out and just killing animals at their leisure.
Right.
There's actual seasons and there's limits. And what that does is adjust these herds, because as humans are spreading out through this world and where our population is growing, we're impacting the environment that these animals live in. So we do have to control the population in a sense. Through hunters is a great way to do it.
All right, man. Listen, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you. And hey, Cam, like always, man, thank you for what you do for us.
Your first source for Second Amendment news and information. It is Cam and Company right here on NRA TV and Sirius XM Patriot 125. We have legislative news to report. Also, news out of New Mexico on a compensated confiscation program held in Taos. Meanwhile, we've got Brian Lilly from Beyond the News with us on the program right now. Brian, how are you today, sir?
Doing well. You're playing Rush for me again, and I've left the nation's capital of Ottawa, the Canadian nation's capital, and just was driving through Rush's hometown, the part of Toronto that they're from. So,
really? Well, there you go. It's serendipity.
Very appropriate, I'd say.
Absolutely. All right. So help me out with this story. I'm looking here from the CBC in Canada. More than 1 million restricted and prohibited guns in Canada, and that number of restricted firearms rose 5.5% last year. The number of prohibited firearms in Canada edged up 0.5%. Brian, if these things are restricted and prohibited, how come more people apparently are owning them?
The prohibited one is tough to figure out, because prohibited... Restricted means that you have to have a license for it.
Okay.
We've talked about our licensing system in Canada. Please don't adopt it. It's not great. You know, look, as far as some of the aspects of hopefully keeping the guns out of the hands of crazy folk, maybe there's some benefit there. But overall, I think it's too onerous, and that's something we've talked about. But there's two classes of license. You can just get a basic gun license, and if you want to own a 22 or a shotgun or your average 303 hunting rifle sort of thing, you can buy that. But if you want to own a restricted firearm, and believe it or not, this includes the AR-15,
mm-hmm.
or you want any handgun, then you need a restricted license. That's just an extra day in the classroom, another test to do, and maybe I don't even think the background check is any more onerous. It's just more time and more paperwork.
Okay.
So all of that goes on, and people are getting when they go, because you know you're going to spend time taking the gun course and writing your test and getting your license. Most people now are getting their restricted license. Also because just like in the United States, the increase is not due to more people hunting.
Right.
They want the AR-15 because they want to go to the range. They want the handgun because they want to go to the range. It's the shooting sports. That's what's driving up gun ownership in Canada, just like it is in the United States. So that's why the restricted is up 5.5%. I think in the story there was a bit of a mention of prohibited might just be people moving, because prohibited are people that were grandfathered in mm-hmm. when we brought in this licensing system back in the 90s. And once they die, those guns have to be surrendered. So if you've got, I know a guy who was just at a meeting of the CSSA, Canadian Shooting Sports Association, with Tony Bernardo, and there was a fellow there that had two FNs, the old Canadian and European NATO rifle. Great rifle. Fired them all the time when I was in the cadets and the reserves. Those are prohibited. He can't pass them on to family members.
Oh, wow. That,
yeah.
And again, you talk about the differences in gun laws between Canada and the United States. I guess there are some California laws that get awfully close to that, but thankfully nothing like that in the state of Virginia where I live. But, I understand, too, that I think Tony Bernardo said something about the increase in the quote-unquote prohibited firearms maybe due to prop houses, like more movies are being made in British Columbia now, and so it may be that you've got more of those guns being brought in for cinematic purposes.
Yeah, and I've been on sets. In fact, I remember being on set with Samuel L. Jackson and Gina Davis for an action movie, and it's a lot of fun watching them shoot up a whole set with all the fake bullets going off and bullet holes appearing places and seeing that. A lot of those things happen here in Toronto, in Montreal, and in British Columbia and around Vancouver. Lots of movies shot there, so that's part of it. But, my main problem with this article, Cam, is that it is fear-mongering from the state broadcaster again. CBC is, we could call it the Communist Broadcasting Corporation instead of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And this particular writer is someone that I've worked with, was involved in letting her and a bunch of people go because they were just so awful when we took over Sun Media and Sun News. And she's obsessed with guns. So she puts out this story on the increase in restricted and prohibited firearms.
Mm-hmm.
Non-gun owners, for the most part, don't know what that means.
Right.
And I've got people arguing with me on Twitter saying, well, of course we have to stop this. And I said, why? Well, to keep us safe. Has gun crime gone up? No. There's a crazy statement from Wendy Kukier in there, but
let's repeat myself. Well, let's talk about that that statement by Wendy Kukier. Said the 5.5% increase in restricted firearms is an improvement over the increases that took place during the Conservative government. She said, quote, the good news is that it has slowed down. The bad news is that we're not a lot further ahead than we were a year and a half ago. And she said a million restricted and prohibited firearms in this country suggest that handguns are much more readily available than many Canadians know. So,
They don't know because there's no problems with them.
Well, unless, again, you're a gun control advocate, right? In which case, it is the simple ownership of that firearm. It doesn't matter how many barriers you put between the potential gun owner and the firearm. It doesn't matter how many hoops and hurdles they have to jump through. At the end of the day, if they can still get that firearm, that's the problem for Wendy Kukier, and that's the problem for the gun control advocates out there.
Yeah, and so they want more done. Now, Justin Trudeau has promised to do more. Justin Trudeau has promised he's bringing in the UN Arms Trade Treaty, which is a disaster. John Kerry signed it, never even attempted to give it to the Senate because he knew it wouldn't get passed. The Conservative government of Stephen Harper, when they were still in power, did not have Canada sign it because they said, we think there's problems. They would not sign it. They would not ratify it. Trudeau is bringing it in. He also wants to bring in the UN marking system, which means every time that we import a rifle from the United States or a handgun from the United States, the importer has to put on a new serial number specific with a country code and a year of import. It's going to drive up, I'm told, the cost of some rifles by $200-$300. And that is going to make it less affordable. Hey, They like that. Mm-hmm. Harass people out of firearms ownership. That's a big part of it.
Yeah, that's not a bug. That's a feature, Ryan.
Yep, and I mentioned the crazy statement from Wendy Kuchar. I lost it because there's so much of what she says is true, or is crazy. But she said that Canadians want action on firearms issues. She said, especially in the last year, we've seen some horrific cases of legally owned guns being used in domestic violence incidents, in hate crimes, and terrorist activities. I follow the news on a daily basis, Cam. I'd love to know which terrorist activity involved a legally purchased firearm.
You did, that one didn't ring a bell for you?
No.
No. And apparently the reporter for the CBC didn't ask.
And they wouldn't. They absolutely wouldn't. It is beyond their ken to even consider to ask that sort of question.
I suppose so. And she said that to me signals we need to do a better job. Now, Scott Bardsley, also quoted as a spokesman for the public safety minister, said the government has been taking action on a number of fronts, including a rescinding a directive from the former public safety minister on gun classification, quote, talking with cities about ways to make it harder for criminals to get guns. That sounds specific there, Brian, and announcing plans to end the amnesty for long gun owners with lapsed licenses and working on amendments to firearms marketing regulations. So let's talk about that amnesty for a second. So the Trudeau government wants to end that amnesty, and instead, again, if you fail to declare that firearm, or if you let your license lapse, what would happen to you? Would you go to jail? Would you be fined?
Well, if you let your license lapse and the way that the conservatives brought it in, it wasn't an amnesty. They changed the legislation so that you would have been considered in possession of an illegal gun. But they were trying to grant people grace periods so that if it's just a paperwork mistake, you're not going to be facing 3 to 14 years in jail for illegally possessing a firearm. The liberals want to do away with that. So if things get lost in the mail, you could be in trouble. Now, nobody that I know of has actually, despite the fact that I think the cops in our country that actually work on the firearms issue, but despite the fact that I think many of them don't like civilian firearms ownership, they do tend to work with people. And most of the guys that I've encountered and talking to them, they say, look, the CFO, the chief firearms officer, is really good. You call them, you tell them you got a problem, they'll work through it with you. But I wouldn't be, you know, surprised that there's some in Trudeau's cabinet and his caucus that would love to see him crack down. And hey, you're one day over, charge him.
But the long gun registry went away in Canada, right?
Yeah, it did.
Okay, but so the licensing of the long guns is still in effect.
Licensing is still in effect, and handgun license or handgun registry. It's still in effect.
Okay.
It could be as simple as you're pulled over for something on the highway and you're in the middle of coming back from the range. Well, let me see all your paperwork. Oh, your license is out of date by a day. That sort of thing. Those are the types of ways they could find out, or something happens at your home and they're investigating. It's really unfortunate that they take such a dim view of firearms owners, but as you know, the story that Thomas Sowell told about government programs, the French police chase a bank robber into a building. They don't have enough men to surround that building to make sure he doesn't go out, so they surround the building next door because it's smaller and they can do that. That's kind of what the government's doing. We do have, not to the same degree, but say Chicago or Dade County or these places have with gun violence, but in Toronto there's a problem. In Vancouver, they've had a horrible gang and gun issue. But instead of dealing with that, that's an intractable problem. Okay, what do we do? Let's surround the building that's smaller. Mm-hmm. Let's deal with and harass the legal firearms owners. It makes no sense to anyone that's using logic. But an awful lot of this, and this is what I was getting into with people on Twitter today, it's driven by feelings, Cam, and they just start saying, I feel like we would be safer if you didn't have a gun.
it is driven by feelings. And again, I think for the anti-gun advocates, that is that's not a bug. That's a feature as well, because if you have to explain, you know, what legislation does, what it ignores, Brian, what the unintended consequences are, that takes time, right? It's so much easier to say, well, I feel like we shouldn't have guns. I feel like you, Brian, shouldn't be able to own a firearm.
Good news is gun ownership is up and crime is not.
That is good news. And I feel like, unfortunately, we have to take a break, Brian, because the music means we're out of time. But thank you, as always, sir, for coming on the program. Great talk with you today. Brian Lilly from Beyond the News, Tim Graham of the Media Research Center, Rhonda Ezell of Chicago Guns Matter, all coming up next hour. Stick around. Hour two of Cam & Company, fueled by Hornady, coming up next.
This is a very unique race here, the Bass Pro NRA 500 here at Bristol. Give you a little feel for Bristol. You go around it in about 15 and a half seconds. And you got 40 cars on a half-mile racetrack. It's really, really tight.
Even though it's a tight racing and rough racing, you got to be patient. You can't tear your car up too early. You got to be able to be around at the end.
Things happen so fast, and that's what makes it just an awesome place to be, because there's action all over the track for the fans to watch and see.
Our fans, you will not find a more patriotic sport than NASCAR. These fans love our freedom, our Second Amendment, our Constitution, our liberty. That's what this country was built on. That's the kind of people that our fans are, our drivers. And it just gives me great honor to be here.
What makes Bristol so special is this is the last great Coliseum. And you can tell by when you first walk in this place, if you look up and you're surrounded by fans, the track is so banked and you're right on top of the action.
I came to Bristol probably in 1969 for the first race. Probably had 10 to 15,000 seats in the grandstand. There was an old guardrail around it. People sat on the grass banks in the back of it. And it was asphalt. And today, the track holds 160,000 people. It's the last great Coliseum, I guess you would want to call it. It builds so much energy for the fans. It builds so much energy for the drivers and pit crews. So it has something very special about it. That's why I say it's Bristol, baby.
Things just happen quicker here. You know, you got to stay in the race to win the race.
It's real tight racing. It's bumper to bumper, and you got to move people and make things happen.
As a driver, I had a lot of fun. Some of my best finishes were here. You know, Austin Dillon and Ty Dillon are grandsons, and they both race in NASCAR. As a car owner, I've had cars to finish 1, 2, 3, won the race, finish second and third. And we've also, as a car owner, loaded three of them on the rollback and took them home. So it can go either way. It's feast or famine at Bristol. Now I look back and think how it was on my daughter and my wife when I was driving. So I guess I'm getting payback for whatever you say.
You know, I had to put myself in a good position, and it sucks for Ty. He had such a good run going, and the moves he was making were really impressive. And we just kind of let the race come to us. We had a good car all night, a third and fourth place car. And when it all said and done and everything played out, we were the car to win. So it was a bummer for him, but I'm glad we're in victory lane. Go up that hill, I get to do a burnout on the way up. All the history that's taking place here and to be a part of it is special.
We'll take it any way we can get it. We love these fans here in Bristol. They were cheering loud over there in the front stretch and burning it down. And hopefully we can do something like this tomorrow night. Love this place, and I want to get as many fans as we can in here.
TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right this second. Tim Graham of the Media Research Center joins us here in about 20 minutes or so. Also, Rhonda Ezell with Chicago Guns Matter. I loved Rhonda's response on Twitter to the story from the Chicago Sun-Times. The headline yesterday, reluctant alderman relaxed shooting range rules with minor changes. Rhonda's take was, they had to. They were told by a court they had to do this. It's not like they, you know, okay, we'll recognize the Second Amendment. This is why I say I would love to be cautiously optimistic that because of the changes there in Chicago, we will see a range open up within the city limits one day relatively soon. But I am not cautiously optimistic. I'm not. Because we've already seen two lawsuits directed against the city of Chicago over this. And the city of Chicago has dragged its heels. It's you know, at first it had an outright ban, then it had a ban. Theoretically, you could open up a gun shop or a range, but practically speaking, no, it was a ban by another name. So, I'm not convinced that the city of Chicago is really willing to drop this. And I guess the test is going to come the first time we get some applications for ranges. And in a city of, nearly 3 million people, there's a market for a range or two or three in Chicago. But what happens when someone actually applies for one of those special use permits? Do they get approved? Do they all just get denied? And we have to go back to court again? We'll talk about it again with Rhonda Ezell from Chicago Guns Matter later in the hour. And next hour, Dan Bongino joins us from Conservative Review as well. In Taos, New Mexico, they held a compensated confiscation program recently, otherwise known as a quote-unquote gun buyback. John Miller at Taos News reports that more than 40 firearms were turned in during the inaugural Guns to Gardens gun buyback. Yeah, sawed apart right there on site to be turned into gardening implements. John Miller of the Taos News says, after initial coverage of the event reached more than 8,000 readers in a 24-hour period, the comments on the Taos News Facebook page were flying too, with not everyone characterizing the event in the same way. 78 comments were generated. Yeah, they're actually writing about the response on social media. Easy way to do a story, I suppose. With some users supporting the event's stated mission to reduce gun violence, but a majority of the comments criticized what was interpreted by some as a not too subtle suggestion that gun ownership in general is a bad thing. One critic, James Martinez, captain of the Thunderbird Fire District in Maricopa, Arizona, received the highest number of likes for one comment, which was set off by angry emoticons. God, I love journalism in the 21st century. Giving up your guns is suicide to your rights, he wrote. Education of proper handling is the key to gun safety. You giving up your guns will not take them out of the criminal's hands. It will only make you an easier target. Others disagreed. One, Sharon, wrote LOLing at the sputtering, red-faced anger of people who are absolutely furious because some other people decided that they didn't need a gun. The anger at someone else's choice, which doesn't affect them, is proof positive that they're not mentally stable enough to be allowed to own guns. Oh, really? Huh. You guys, she said, are your own worst argument. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? We don't want to take anybody's guns away, but I think you're too angry to own them. Isn't that nice? As for the actual buyback itself, or the compensated confiscation program, Miranda Viscoli, founder of New Mexicans to Prevent Gun Violence, says we got 42. The firearms, she said, included two quote-unquote assault weapons, four semi-automatic handguns, and a sawed-off shotgun. About 35 people dropped them off, she said. One of the best turnouts, apparently, for the group. This is, I think, the third event that they have held in New Mexico. Shotguns, long rifles, 1920s era snub-nosed revolvers, even a replica black powder rifle. Mr. Miller with the Taos News reported that while participants remained anonymous, organizers said that some were women whose husbands had passed away and left weapons behind that they no longer needed or wanted. Others were former target shooters or hunters. now out of the game and looking to turn over their unused firearms in exchange for a gift certificate to one of several retailers, including Best Buy, CVS, gas stations, Albertsons, Smith's, or Target. Not a lot of criminals, it sounds like, going to this event to change their ways and drop off their firearms and start life anew. But then again, that doesn't happen at these events, which is why most jurisdictions don't hold these events, unless they're looking again for some public relations benefit, because they're good for that. I mean, the media will show up and then they'll talk about this. And again, if you got festive visuals, like people destroying the guns right there, just with a saw, oh my gosh, you're bound to get on the local news. As far as actually making a difference, though, in violent crime, in terms of firearm accidents, there's no evidence that any of these quote-unquote buybacks actually do anything productive. They allow a politician to say we're doing something, but as far as actually doing something effective, not so much. So there you go. 42 guns handed in Taos, New Mexico. And they call that a rousing success. Meanwhile, in the real world, our friend AWR Hawkins at Breitbart points out, while concealed carry licenses were increasing across the country, we now, again, according to the Crime Prevention Research Center, have a record high number of concealed carry holders in this country, 15.7 million, they say. While those numbers were going up, what was happening to the homicide rate? NRA tweeted this out yesterday afternoon. Between 2007 and 2015, the number of concealed carry permit holders increased 215%. At the same time, the homicide rate dropped 14%. The overall violent crime rate dropped 21%. While the number of concealed carry holders going up. Now, listen, I got to tell you, I think that's newsworthy. But this always gets left out of the coverage of Second Amendment issues by the media. The fact that while this was taking place, while the right to carry revolution was taking place in this country, while more and more states were adopting shall issue concealed carry laws, and more Americans were getting their concealed carry license, violent crime was not climbing. It was not increasing. Dr. A.W. Hawkins says, back on December 4th, 2013, Breitbart News reported a congressional research study that showed a similar correlation between gun ownership and plummeting murder rates. Gun ownership climbed from 192 million firearms in 1994 to 310 million firearms in 2009. Murder rates, according to the congressional research study, fell sharply during the same time period. Again, the basic foundational belief of the anti-gun advocates is more guns equals more crime, right? I mean, that's the foundation of all of their policies, of all of their philosophies. More guns equals more crime. That's why they think gun safety means don't own a gun. And yet, again, what actually happened? While the number of privately owned firearms in this country increasing from 192 million to 310 million, the murder rate dropping, the firearm-related murder and non-negligent homicide rate in 1993, 6.6 per 100,000 Americans. By 2000, it had fallen to 3.6. By 2011, it was 3.2. More guns, less crime. More concealed carry holders, less crime. And again, you will never see this reported in the mainstream media. You will not see this lead the nightly news. I mean, heck, we got a big enough problem with the media reporting on the actual crime rate in this country. And they certainly didn't want to report it going up during the last years of the Obama administration. Weren't real eager to talk about that. But they also never wanted to talk about the increase in gun ownership, the decline in homicides at the very same time. You know, it's interesting, too. I was looking at a story earlier today because the Tennessean newspaper has a story. State overdose data sheds new light on the opioid crisis in Tennessee. And the numbers are staggering. Tennessee Department of Health issuing this new report detailing, they say, a surge of deaths between 2012 and 2015. In 2015, they say at least 1,451 Tennesseans died from drug overdoses. Over the past 5 years, there's been 6,036 drug overdose deaths in Tennessee. But just in 2015, there were 1,451 drug overdose deaths. So I was curious. There were, in 2015, 406 homicides in all of Tennessee. Now, that's not just gun-related homicides. That's all homicides. 406. 1,400-plus drug overdose deaths in the state of Tennessee. Again, something that mainstream media typically doesn't talk about. We may hear about the opioid epidemic, but rarely do we hear these numbers compared. I've actually seen these numbers compared more to like traffic fatalities. But in states and in cities across the country, the number of overdose deaths dwarfing right now the number of deaths due to violent crime. Even again, in states like Tennessee, we talked about Cincinnati, where last year there were, I think, 525 shootings and over 2,000 overdose calls. I mean, it really is just absolutely staggering. As a matter of fact, ABC News, I will give credit to ABC News for this. They had a story yesterday about one of the ancillary effects of what we're seeing here with the opioid epidemic around the country. Shortage of foster parents. And we don't even think about this, but it makes sense, right? If you have more kids whose parents are being arrested or whose parents are dying, there is a need for more foster families. Catherine Shea is a licensed clinical social worker, president of the Florida Center for Early Childhood, told ABC News that the problem is especially acute in Florida's Judicial Circuit 12, which includes Sarasota, Manatee, and DeSoto counties. In 2016, in July of 2015, the circuit administered, according to ABC News, a record 281 doses of Narcan. By July 2016, the number had doubled from 281, well, more than doubled, to 749 doses of Narcan. They've also seen an increase in the number of children removed from their homes and placed in foster care. Connie Keener, the Child Protective Investigative Supervisor for the Manatee County Sheriff's Office, says our foster care homes are so saturated, we just don't have enough left. Like, in this circuit in Florida, there are 159 foster homes. Between 2013 and 2014, the Florida Department of Children and Families removed 395 children from their homes in that same circuit. And then in 2015, they removed 880 children from their home in that same district. Again, 159 foster homes to house these kids. That is honestly something I had never even really considered until today. But again, as we talk about the staggering effects all across the country, and the numbers are not going down despite the prevalence of Narcan, and not just in patrol cars, not just in ambulances, but again in places like libraries, now sold over the counter in a lot of pharmacies, despite the prevalence of this anti-OD drug, we are seeing more and more overdose deaths. All right, when we come back, Matter of fact, I'll give you one more quick story here. We had talked about this last week. An officer in Ohio, East Liverpool, Ohio, made a traffic stop. Guys were trying to get rid of the evidence. There were powder all over the car. He ended up getting some on his uniform, brushed it off later, ended up ODing. Another one of these stories, this time from Maryland, Hartford, Maryland. Maryland Sheriff's Deputy, two EMTs received treatment for possible heroin and fentanyl exposure after responding to a drug overdose. This was last Friday. Got a call. Somebody had OD'd. They show up. EMTs gave the deputy a dose of Narcan when the deputy got sick trying to revive that individual. And then the EMT who administered the Narcan to the deputy started feeling sick. So he got Narcan. The other EMT also fell ill. Fox 8 out of Baltimore says authorities still aren't sure how the drugs got to the first responders who were wearing gloves. One of the spokesmen for the Harford County Sheriff's Office says, we don't know if the deputy touched or inhaled something. Don't know if we'll ever have a definitive answer. But again, a reminder of the danger, not only to the addicts, but to the first responders who are hoping to save their life now and may end up risking their own. All right, we do need to step away for just a moment or two. When we come back, Tim Graham of the Media Research Center is going to be with us talking about this new Harris-Harvard poll. Majority say the mainstream media publishing fake news. 65% of voters say there is a lot of fake news in the mainstream media. 65% of Americans say the news media is giving us a bunch of baloney. We'll talk about that and what it means with Tim Graham of the Media Research Center right after this.
So what can the public do to help hero hunting?
The biggest thing right now, obviously, is financial support helps us because it helps us buy licenses. It helps us get gas. It helps us get to where we need to go to the different events that people put on for us and the events that we put on for ourselves. I mean, the events that we put on for our heroes. So that, if there are any outfitters out there that want to donate some of their time or their location to bring some guys out, we keep small groups because we've dealt with bigger groups before. And it's not personal. There's 10 or 15 people running around. You got to be here. You got to be there. We keep it 3 to 5 on every event. That way, it's a personal experience. That's where the family concept comes from. These started on our farm in Nashville, bringing people we didn't even know into our homes, pairing up with guides and family members, and taking them out on these hunts on our farm. And we sit around our family dinner table, and that's where we started. We're very grassroots, and that's what we do. So the biggest thing we need. We need help financially. We need places to take them to, and just spread the word in case there are people out there who don't know about us, who are in a bad place, who we can help. We're on Facebook. We're at HeroHuntInc @gmail.com, and our website is HeroHuntInc.org.
So, listen, I wish you guys all the best. If you are looking for places to hunt in Virginia, let me know, because I know some folks who've got some land.
Oh, wow.
And again, I mean, this is just such a critical mission that you guys are on. Saw another story this morning, actually, of a veteran who committed suicide yesterday. Leaves behind a wife and two kids. This is happening every day. It's happening way too often. And you know, I want the men and women to know that they're not alone, that they don't have to feel this way, that there is help, and that there are people out there who understand. Like, I don't understand. I confess, I've never been in a war zone. I've never been in combat. Never served in law enforcement. But there are people out there who have those experiences, who can help, who do want to help, and are willing and waiting for folks to reach out. And they're trying to reach out as well. So thank you guys for what you're doing.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
We appreciate your time, and we appreciate the opportunity to come out and talk to you guys today. This advertising dollars are so expensive for us, but this gets it out in front of some people that maybe we can save some lives.
Joe, Jose, thank you both, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Great seeing you. Thanks so much. Hero Hunt, Inc. here at NRA Annual Meeting.
All America lies at the end of the wilderness road, and our past is not a dead past, but still lives in us. Our forefathers had civilization inside themselves, the wild outside. We live in the civilization they created, but within us, the wilderness still lingers. What they dreamed, we live. And what they lived, we dream. It is the dream of the animal rights fanatics to suppress your most natural connection to the earth, to sell you a life filled with urban fascinations, to ignore that death is life's unwavering partner, together creating a relationship between predator and prey that makes it possible for us all to survive. To the hunter, this world's most honest steward, these fantasies are the poisonous, perverted manipulations of social misfits who would take this planet hostage. They should startle you and awaken you to trust the hunter in your blood.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Top of the hour, today's hero of the day. Plus, we've got our deal of the day, good guy as well. And Tim Graham of the Media Research Center is with us on the program right now. Tim, how are you, sir? All right.
I'm getting hounded on Twitter.
What about?
The left now presumes that I have cheered on the brutalizing of the jerk from The Guardian. So,
okay.
I'm insufficiently outraged.
Okay. So what was your take? What particularly has them so incensed about you, Mr. Graham? You seem like a fairly reasonable guy to me.
One of the tweet I had put out last night was probably – it was badly timed. I, of course, was watching like the 35 or 40-minute freakout on All In with Chris Hayes. And I said, ask why on earth a House candidate in Montana should have to answer questions from a reporter from a British newspaper. You know, he should be expected to answer the questions from the reporter from Billings or Bozeman or Butte. And I know this Ben Jacobs. He is not a friend of mine, and I just think, don't answer his question. Now, granted, you don't throw him either, but you could just say, get out.
Yes, and probably should have. You know, but it's interesting because we're looking at this poll here yesterday. The Hill-Harvard poll comes out. 65% of voters believe that there's a lot of fake news in the mainstream media. I would say, Tim, that there is a lot of frustration, that there is a lot of anger towards the media. And, you know, what you haven't seen from the media is any acknowledgement that any of that is appropriate, right? I mean, the media is still insisting, by and large, that matter of fact, they are the experts, that we need them, that we're ungrateful. Consumers of
yep.
news and information, and darn it, we don't know
right.
what the hell we're talking about. So, you know, I think that the media itself needs to realize beyond this one incident in Montana yesterday, we've got a serious problem in the country right now. When you've got 2/3 of the country, including a majority of Democrats, saying that the media is putting out a lot of fake news every day.
Yeah. Well, I think that I can put myself in the shoes of a liberal media person, and what they're going to say is, one, fake news is a Trump phrase, therefore it's a lie. You know, anything Trump says is a lie. It's a taunt, it's not an actual argument. And I think what I would say to that is, you know, they would say everything we've reported is true. And the answer to that is no. There's a whole bunch of things you're reporting that are neither true, they're not proven true, and they're also not facts. So when you spend 24 breathless hours a day saying we think maybe Trump colluded with the Russians, you are not dealing, you know, that's part of what people are saying is what you're doing here is pushing a narrative. It's, you're not pushing facts. You're pushing facts that match your narrative and ignoring facts that don't match your narrative. And when we point out facts that don't match your narrative, you call them alternative facts and suggest they are fake. And so there's so much of this phrase fake news. It's not just that what they're saying is false. It's what they're saying is news is not news. It's opinion and speculation and spin. It's not news. It's not an attempt to say here's what happened today. It's an attempt to say here's what you need to think.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And to that end, so we can debate and argue about what that phrase fake news even means to people, right? As you'd say, the Liberal Reporter would say, wow, that's a Trump phrase to disregard it. But they also ask, is it easy or difficult for you to believe the news that you see online? And 84% of voters, Tim, says it's hard to know what to believe online. So if you want maybe an even vaguer definition of fake news, there you go. And the problem gets even worse, right? What do you know? Do you know what to believe when you read it online? 84% of voters are saying, no, I don't.
Well, and this to some degree is what happens when you run around and they said, you know, your news is fake. And then the other side says your news is fake. And what happens is then everybody thinks the news is fake. And it's the same way that the news media, after bringing down Nixon, after, you know, bringing down, ruining the Vietnam War from having any kind of successful conclusion. And they said, wow, people don't have any faith in their institutions. No, they don't, because you've spent the last 10 years running the institutions down.
Well, and this piece of the Hill says many conservatives believe the media has dramatically loosened its reporting standards when it comes to Trump, taking an anything-goes approach and running with anonymously sourced material that would never print about a more traditional Republican or Democratic administration. Many conservatives believe that, Tim. Just many conservatives. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is what I'm saying is, I've been very adamant about the way that the media is waging war on Trump with anonymous people. It's one of the most disreputable things, and it's not, you can't call it professional. They want to say that Trump is authoritarian. This is authoritarian. You are being accused by anonymous enemies who want to take you to court or ruin your administration, impeach your presidency based on, then they stay behind a wall and accuse you without you never, ever knowing who they are. And a lot of this stuff, again, is, this is where people think that the news media is making this stuff up, because they actually give people the right anonymously to say, I think Trump is paranoid and delusional, says a senior White House aide. I mean, this is where you're like, well, who is it? That's not an assertion of fact. That's an assertion of amateur psychoanalysis and smear.
Or as we've seen former officials say, right? Which is even worse, because now you're talking about somebody who's not in the administration. Well, why give them anonymity if they're going to make this claim? Why are you providing them a screen to hide behind? If they're not currently in the administration, they don't have to worry about losing their job. Tell them to go public.
I am trying to slog my way through what you might call the cover stories for the dying magazine known as Time, where they have this stupid cover where the White House turns into the Kremlin, or actually some Orthodox cathedral, because they're not smart enough to know what the Kremlin looks like.
Yeah.
And it's the whole story is anonymous source said this, a senior official said that, an anonymous source said that. There's more people off, you know, anonymous than real people on the record. And that's what's wrong with journalism. It's like, yes, I tweeted this like last week. We should just have a deny anonymous sources week. Everything anonymous source says will hereby be treated as false because they're not, you know, I agree. None of that is true because you won't give me a source. If you don't tell me who this person is, you could say a former government official said Trump was this, and it was Barack Obama or Bill Clinton. Masking the identity is what, you know, it hurts from you being able to evaluate the accuser. So what you have here is a bunch of stories making breathless claims about Trump or anyone else using anonymous sources. And yes, if we had run stories like this in the Clinton years where it said an anonymous source said, and then Clinton did this to her, do you think any of them would have tolerated it?
That would have been, you would have been part of the vast right-wing conspiracy, Tim.
Well,
and it would have been shoddy journalism, right? It would have been seen
And I'm not saying that would be good journalism. I'm saying that's precisely what they're doing. They're making a lot of claims that you can't prove. So yeah, the idea that Trump's delusional is an opinion. It's a snarky, mean opinion. And to say we need, due to the sensitivity of the matter, we've decided to mask his identity. Oh, I'm sorry, his or her identity. You might not know. They may not know. They may not have identified their own gender. So that's where we're just not going to take any lectures over here in the conservative territory about what real news is, because these people don't seem to have been able to find it. They've just lost their minds. That's the way it reads to me.
You know, it seems to me like when you've got this broad a cross section of America who are concerned about this, it would be wise for the media to also be concerned about this. But I'm with you, Tim. I don't see this being a concern, because, you know, look, if you're a member of the media, you can spend all day long talking to your colleagues. And, you know, if you're interacting with people on social media, it's easy to turn them out. It's easy to mute them. Right. You don't like what they're saying, or maybe someone's a jackass. And so you just mute. And you talk to the people who, you know, you talk to the people who you like. You talk to the people who you agree with, by and large. And you are able to, I think, convince yourself in many ways that I don't need to pay attention to what these people are telling me. I don't need to pay attention to those eggs out there, or the people with, you know, 30 followers. What do they have to tell me, even though they're your audience or they're your potential audience?
Yeah. I think it can be argued that the liberal media today see their audience as just sheep to be guided. You know, that's the way, and they're unhappy. They're big enough hypocrites that they think the Fox News audience is a pile of sheep who can't think for themselves. And then they go out every night and say, here's what all you MSNBC sheep should think. Here are your marching orders. And somehow that's different. It's not. And CNN's as bad as MSNBC, if not worse. The people running the CNN media unit are completely uncorked. You can't tell the difference between them and the staff of Media Matters. They're all trying to get Fox killed. You know, you can't – they're on a crusade. They're on a campaign. They're running a political campaign to ruin a news network. And then they say, we're the journalists. We're the ones who are pro-journalism. Because apparently they think that they have to – until Fox News is utterly destroyed or compromised to become another CNN, then that news hasn't happened yet. So it's just a nasty environment right now.
It is. And unfortunately, I really don't see it getting any better anytime soon. And it pains me to say that, because I am an eternal optimist, Tim. But I don't see it.
I'd like to be one, but it's not my time.
Well, listen, buddy, I appreciate you coming on the program today. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Cam.
All right. We'll do this again soon. Tim Graham with the Media Research Center here on Cam and Company. Rhonda Ezell of Chicago Guns Matter still to come later on in the program. And again, you know, the number of Americans who say, yeah, fake news, I see it a lot from the media, 65%. But you ask people again, do you trust what you read online? Do you trust the news that you're getting online, which is how most of us are getting our news? 84% say no. I don't know how to trust. I don't know if I trust what I'm seeing there on the news, what I'm seeing in my Facebook feed. I mean, that is, at some point, like, that doesn't last forever. You can't have 84% of Americans not trust the news that they're getting and still pay close attention to the news, right? That'd be the first thing. People will tune it out. Well, I don't know what to believe anymore, so I'm just not going to pay any attention. And we need an educated and informed populace. And, you know, and look, we could talk about this with Tim for hours, honestly, because I think a big part of this component now is clickbait media. It's how journalists are viewed as a success. How many people read your story? How many people clicked through? How many people watched? And what you have to say and what you're reporting is less important in many cases than the people, the number of eyeballs that you're bringing in. And so, you know what? If the really explosive headline that doesn't have a lot of substance to it, that's going to draw people in, run it. And if we have to edit the story later, if we have to add an addendum 6 or 7 hours after we first posted the story and the traffic has died down a little bit, correcting and downplaying some of the big explosive things that we hinted at, well, we can do that. No big deal. Again, that has gone from being something that is problematic, having to correct a story afterwards. That used to be kind of a big deal. You really wanted to get it right the first time. Even if the newspaper would report this correction in the agate type, you know, inside page A1, they had their own ways of downplaying the corrections. It was still something that wasn't part of the normal part of writing a story. And now it seems to me like it really has become almost a given. It's okay. Your boss, your editor, they're not going to call you aside. They're not going to say, listen, you keep reporting this stuff. And then we have to keep going back and saying, well, actually, this is what happened. And that's a problem. Instead, I think they're more likely to be pulled aside and told, hey, you know what? This was fantastic. Look at the click-throughs here. Look at the page views for this story. This is amazing. Now, we, you know, went back a few hours later and actually said, put in some quotes and context and some stuff that we probably should have had the first time around. But still, you know what? Keep it up. This is great. I think members of the media are getting encouraged by the industry to be bad journalists right now. And I think that is obviously it's a recognizable problem for the American people. But I'll be honest with you, other than, again, individual reporters, individual journalists trying to do the best job that they can do, I wish I had a better answer. If you've got one, let me know, because we need one. Because it is getting worse, it seems. All right, when we come back here on this edition of Cam and Company, we're going to talk with Rhonda Ezell from Chicago Guns Matter. The city council, however reluctantly, abiding by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decision that they need to rewrite their laws regarding gun ranges, and they need to do it right this time. We'll find out from Rhonda what she thinks about the new rules. So stick around. There's much more Cam and Company coming up right after this. Jana Waller, the host of Skullbound TV, is with us on the show. I thought about you when I saw this story last week, and I should have known that there's more than one hunter in Montana who's gone looking for dinosaur bones, because you yourself have spent some time not looking for elk or bear in Montana, but looking for creatures long gone. This is so cool.
I have. So last summer, I had the opportunity to go on my very first dino dig. We went with Eric Siegfried, who is the owner of Onyx Maps here in Missoula, Montana. His mom has a piece of property over in eastern Montana that is known for dinosaur bones. And we spent 2.5 days getting all muddied, getting all dirtied, and just hunting for bones, teeth, claws, you name it. And we had a lot of success. Jimmy actually found a big triceratops rib bone. We found lots of small teeth and claws, part of a T-Rex tooth. I found a lot of hadrosaur teeth and triceratops, smaller bones, but we had such a blast. And it's addicting like any other form of hunting.
Well, and now that you know that David Bratt, who 7 years ago discovered this fossil that turns out to be a previously undiscovered species, I mean, he's had this named after him now, Nakonanectus Bratti. We could have the Skullboundosaurus if you keep hunting for dinosaurs one day.
Oh, hey. Goals. Hashtag goals. That's all I have to say. I mean, wouldn't that be such a trip? I can't imagine, you know, uncovering, because there are a lot of small pieces of stuff we didn't even know, you know, what they belong to. I cannot imagine discovering a brand new species of dinosaurs. But I saw the same article and all hashtag goals, man.
But, you know, it's so cool. And I know that's not why David Bratt was out there. He was out there looking for an elk when he just, you know, happened to see this and thought, this is really interesting. But here's the thing, Jenna, unless you're out there, right, unless you're out in the field, you have no chance of there's no chance you're going to discover a new species of dinosaur sitting on your couch in your living room. There's just no way.
Exactly. That's half the beauty of hunting right there, is never knowing what you're going to see, never knowing what you're going to find. Every hunter I know is constantly kind of on the lookout for deer, elk sheds that have dropped, arrowheads. I mean, I went on an elk hunt in Oregon a few years ago, and I did not notch that tag, but I found a 4-inch obsidian spear tip that's been dated by two arrowhead experts to be 6,000 or so years old. That was worth the hunt alone for me. I mean, most hunters I know were scroungers, and you're right. If you're not out there, you're not exploring and you know, immersing yourself in that type of environment, you're missing out.
Okay, so I got to tell you, it would have been really cool to fill that tag, but, you know, to hold something in your hand, I mean, as a hunter yourself, to hold that in your hand, something that's 6,000 years old, and to feel that bond, because the person who crafted that spearhead 6,000 years ago, they went out into the field, they were hunting, this was a part of their life. I mean, where else do you find a connection throughout thousands of years of human history like that, Jana?
I've always said that. I've always said that hunting is such a primitive connection to our planet, to the way everyone used to live off the land. And when I found that, I felt a surge of energy. Like I think 4 years ago, I still talk about that on a monthly basis. I show everyone who comes over. It's probably my most prized possession I've ever found. I found lots of small arrowheads and broken pieces and pottery and such, but that obsidian piece to me is, you know, I'll never ever forget that moment. I reached down. There was actually just a tip of it in the sand, and I reached down to pick it up, and just, I was elated. And you're right. That was crafted by another hunter 6,000 years ago. From what I had gathered from the other experts, arrowhead experts, it had never been shot because obsidian was the sharpest material to use at the time, but it would have been exploded on target. So whether it fell out of his satchel or he left it behind, it was seriously one of the coolest gifts I've ever found.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy coming up, top of the hour right now. I want to welcome to the program from Chicago Guns Matter, Rhonda Ezell is with us. Rhonda, how are you?
I'm fine, Kim. How are you today?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. And as I have been saying here, I wish I could be cautiously optimistic, but I'm cautiously cynical about the city of Chicago here. And I saw your reaction on Twitter to the headline of the Chicago Sun-Times about the reluctant signing by the alderman of these new rules. And you said they had to do this. There was no choice. Rhonda, are you optimistic that finally now we may see a range in Chicago, or do you still think the city's going to do everything they can to block any potential ranges from opening up?
I think eventually we will see a gun range in the city of Chicago, because they know that the Ezell versus Chicago case is law of the land. They've expressed this to their aldermen. Everyone knows that we fought this battle for 7 years, thanks to Alan Gura and David Siegel, our attorney, you know. And at this point in time, it's really time for Chicago to put the shenanigans to the side and stop using the lawful people for the scapegoat for the crime that they're dealing with. So I'm looking forward to a change at some point, finally, in Chicago.
All right, I'm going to take your optimism. I'm going to run with it. I'm going to hope that you are right, and that you know, however reluctantly. Here's the thing, Rhonda, right? They don't have to be eager to recognize that you and other residents of Chicago have a constitutional right. They just have to recognize it. They can be as upset or angry about that right as they want, as long as they recognize it, and as long as they quit playing games with your right to keep and bear arms and the right to keep and bear arms of every law-abiding Chicagoan.
Correct, because here's the thing with that. We know that the city of Chicago didn't even want the citizens of the city of Chicago to have a concealed carry license. We know that based on facts. But at the end of the day, they have firearms as well. So it's not just that they're trying to really keep us away from exercising our rights, but they're getting to exercise theirs at the same time. So politically, they want to keep us suppressed so we don't have that right. But it's unfortunate that people are getting on board. People are fighting for their rights. We're making this information available. The city of Chicago know what they have to do now. And it's just a matter of time, you know, before this right is available.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. However, you know, however long it takes, and you know, listen, you've been fighting for this for almost a decade now, and you've gone through multiple lawsuits, and we're now to this point where the city and these aldermen expressing, you know, great disappointment and frustration with the city attorney, but the city attorney said, look, this is what the court said, we have to do this. Now I guess the next test, Ron, is going to be when those applications start showing up, right? You've got to get a special use permit that requires public hearings. And the big question is going to be whether or not one of these special use permits actually gets approved, or whether we just now have a process by which you can get denied to open up a range.
Well, you know, honestly, the city of Chicago is in a position to continue to have the taxpayers paying for lawsuits that they continuously lose to the Amendment, you know, so we will see. But I'm quite sure that the use of a special permit that is needed, we will see who'll be the first one to get one, or how they try to deny an individual, or are they going to go ahead and abide by those Seventh Circuit Court's rulings? Because at this point, we have over 2 million people in Illinois with a FOIA card, and over X amount of numbers with FOIA cards. And people need somewhere to go. It's time to stop playing games. We need a range here. We want to go out and continue educating ourselves and educating the next generation on firearm safety. It's time for the city of Chicago to get on board with that. There is no need to continue to have litigation on the same thing over and over again, and the taxpayers are continuously paying these bills for the city.
Well, you know, and that's—I think that's one of the reasons why we continue to see the city defend the indefensible, right? I mean, it's not their money; it's the taxpayer dollars. And you know, I'm sure they've got. Listen, I bet, Rhonda, they've got anti-gun attorneys who are, you know, offering to help pro bono present the best legal argument. It's just here, you really, the city really is having to defend the indefensible. I mean, the Seventh Circuit has told them not once but twice in crystal clear language that having a place to shoot, having a place to go and get that training, that is a component of our constitutional right to keep and bear arms. And by blocking those ranges, by forcing people to go outside of the city of Chicago, they are infringing on people's right to keep and bear arms. They've made it really simple for the city. It's just you've got some elected officials there who I think don't want to understand. They don't want that message to sink in. They refuse to believe it.
And that's a personal battle, though.
Yep.
But they were sworn into office to uphold the law when they took that oath. So the Seventh Circuit has put forth this saying that the city of Chicago has been found unconstitutional in everything that they brought forth because they didn't have anything to stand on. And so when you have these aldermen talking about, oh, they don't believe this and they don't understand, how could you not understand as a politician that's your job, that is your daily duty? You don't understand the law that is put forth before you? It really doesn't make sense to me.
Well, it doesn't make sense to me either, but this is why we've got folks like you out there fighting, Rhonda, and why we continue to talk to you and follow what's going on there, because, you know, it's not right, but we got folks out there who are setting it right.
Yes. You know, we're going to continue fighting the city of Chicago, litigation after litigation after litigation, because the city of Chicago tends to believe that they are special. I don't know where that comes from. But they have to get on board and respect what the courts have said, move on, accept the fact that this is something that they can't do anything about. Ezell versus Chicago is law of the land. It's not my word. It's the word of the judicial system, the Seventh Circuit Court. They lost two federal lawsuits. The things that they were bringing forth to the court was found unconstitutional. They couldn't prove the point of whatever their myths were, what could happen and what could be, so on and so forth. And this has been explained countless times. So at this point in time, I don't understand why they're still trying to restrict any rights of lawful individuals who are actually following the rules and regulations, who are law-abiding citizens, who has a firearms owner identification card, who has paid to have a concealed carry license, took a training course, 16 hours, and may have given their fingerprints and had a background check from the FBI. What else does one do
in order to
let these people know that you can't mix us up with the gang violence or the violence that you deal with every day in the city of Chicago has nothing to do with a lawful business opening, a gun range opening, the law-abiding citizens that are going to use those facilities. It has nothing to do with that. You can't use us as your scapegoat anymore.
Nope.
Old, it's tired, it's played out. It's time to move on.
And you know, I'd like to think, Rhonda, that when a range does open up, when people in Chicago can actually go and get that training in Chicago, they can go and they can practice, that hopefully that will be a very visible reminder to some of these politicians that we are talking about, you know, the law-abiding citizens of Chicago. We're not talking about the criminals. Frankly, you want to cut down on violent crime, you got to start there. You got to start with the people who are committing the violent crimes. You want to crack down on, you know, straw purchasing? Well, you actually have to deal with straw purchasers, right? Instead of giving them probation and letting them off with a slap on the wrist. But you don't you don't reduce gang violence by going after people who aren't in gangs. You don't reduce drug related violence by going after people who aren't dealing drugs. You don't reduce drive by shootings by going after people who just want to shoot at the range. I mean, it makes no sense that you'd think that you can accomplish those things.
I agree, especially with the straw purchasing, which is already law. So the bill that they put forth against the dealers, the firearm dealers, it's insane because they're not prosecuting the individual. You can't hold a store owner responsible for an individual's action. These things are already existing. They already exist.
Yep.
The state of Illinois tends to want to do these things just to put these people out of business. Gun stores, small business owners, or the ones that are going to be existing gun stores, they will put them out of business. Instead of prosecuting the people that are buying these guns and doing whatever they're doing with them once they get them, all of this already exists in law. And they know that. But once again, they want to point the finger at the lawful because they're not doing their job with the criminal element.
Rhonda Ezell with Chicago Guns Banner. Rhonda, unfortunately, we are almost out of time. But as always, thank you for coming on the program. Thank you for all your activism. And I hope we get a chance to talk again soon.
Sure, Cameron. Thank you for having me. And we would like for the people to go to Facebook.
Facebook.
And go.
Oop, you broke up on us there, Rhonda. Sorry. Facebook.com, Chicago Guns Matter. Is that it?
Correct. Yes.
All right. Rhonda Ezell joins us again from Chicago Guns Matter, also on Twitter at Chicago Guns Matter. And you can find Rhonda on Twitter at Ms_Ezell as well. Now, we've got coming up here in just a couple of minutes today's Hero of the Day, brought to you by Adcore Defense. Our Deal of the Day, plus today's Good Guy, Dan Bongino of Conservative Review, will join us as well. And next hour, we'll also take a look at the DA's report on the terror attack in San Bernardino. It has been released, and there's some interesting stuff, interesting reactions from some of the survivors of that attack as well. Stick around. Much more Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It's coming up next.
What this program will do is it will take you from somebody who has a gun and might have a gun on your hip to somebody who is proficient in using that gun.
I would say I'm still in the beginner's phase in a sense that I didn't really start doing any official training, going to classes, until about a year ago.
If I were to put it on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as proficiency, I would say I'm under 5. That will change because I have made that decision to become as proficient as possible.
With a handgun, I've got a lot more experience, and so I'm a little bit better shot. With a rifle, Caitlin is a better shot because of all the experience she has had.
I've been fortunate enough to do a lot of shooting and be in units that have done a lot of shooting. So when it comes to the legality of it, the responsibility of it, and when it comes to the actual physical training, I think it's awesome.
I have a lot of experience with firearms, but from high-level instructors, they just have infinite knowledge, and it's really nice to learn from people like them.
You know, I've done some classes before, but these guys really break it down into every little step so that you're able to really hone in every little movement.
They all have similar backgrounds, but the diversity in each of them and the stories and experiences they've all had are ideal for someone like myself to walk into this experience.
Oh my gosh, it's definitely a once-in-a-lifetime experience getting training from these amazing guys out here. Gotten so much more out of this than a couple weeks of shooting on my own.
There's things that I've done that are fast. There's things I've done that look good. There's things I've done that work in certain scenarios. These guys are teaching a way that works every time. The heavy burden that you carry, carrying, was where I learned the most.
The right responsibilities is probably one of the more important parts of what you can learn.
On the range and off the range, you know, just knowing what the laws are, how we need to think, the mindset that we need if you are carrying a gun, that it is a big responsibility.
A lot of that information was eye-opening to me, and I hadn't heard it instructed that way, I hadn't heard it presented that way, so it was very educational.
You can always go to the range and shoot at paper, but this class brought in different elements that you don't always do, like low light shooting.
Statistically, things happen mostly after dark when you would need to use your firearm, and so that's a really important skill that I need to have.
With Airsoft, it really helped wrap the whole training experience together, brought the adrenaline level up, the realness of the scenario.
I think it's the best way to learn. I think you can tell somebody something so many times, and you can look at it on paper so many times, but until you get that real tactile response and that adrenaline and that situational scenario, there's no better way to learn.
When the whistle hit and Derek started running, when I pulled out my gun out of my holster and shot, you could see the distance that he got on me, and that's such a huge reality check.
So as parents, this class is really great. The more tools that we have, you know, to protect our kids and our family, I think the better.
This program is great for everyone. I think it's great for someone like me that's carried a long time and had a lot of shooting experience. And I think it's great for someone that's coming in, and this may be the only class they take.
Made in America since 1949. Family owned and operated. Legendary performance. This
is Hornady.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company starts right now here on NRA TV, SiriusX and Patriot 125, fueled by Hornady Ammunition. On the program this hour, today's hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy, plus Dan Bongino from Conservative Review. Also, Quinn Cox later in the hour from Students for Concealed Carry at UT Austin. A new, it's being billed as a study. It's not really a study. But a new paper out in Texas shows that some faculty members are, quote, cautious in the classroom after campus carry. Yes, Nathaniel Craddett, who recently earned his doctorate in higher adult and lifelong education at Michigan State University, interviewed about a dozen professors over 3 weeks at a campus he dubbed Metropolitan University at the end of 2016 for his dissertation, which he presented earlier this month. This is again, talking to a dozen professors at a institution that has over 25,000 students is now a study, supposedly. Anyway, we'll talk about it with Quinn Cox later on in the hour. Right now, I want to get to our hero of the day, our deal of the day, good guy as well. Let's see, hero of the day from the Henry Herald newspaper, story out of Stockbridge, Georgia. 26-year-old man suspected in a Stockbridge armed robbery dead following a Tuesday night home invasion and shooting, according to the Henry County Police Department. Robert McDonald found shot and killed at a home on Kinsey Drive late Tuesday. A homeowner held McDonald at gunpoint after he allegedly broke into the home, and after calling for help, McDonald was shot in his chest by the homeowner's elderly father. So this all started about 9:45 Tuesday night. Officers there in Henry County got called out to a Dollar General store on reports of a robbery where the suspect held a knife to an employee and told her to give him the money in the register. That according to Captain Mike Ireland. Suspect took the money and then ran, jumped into the bed of a pickup truck that was waiting outside. A uniform officer who was responding to the scene attempted to stop the vehicle. The male then jumped from the bed of the pickup truck and fled. Police say while detectives were still on the scene there at the Dollar General, another call came into 911 about an hour later, about an hour after that robbery had been reported. A man matching the description of the armed robbery suspect had broken into that home there in Stockbridge, Georgia, and was shot. The homeowner told responding officers that he was alerted to the intruder by his dog's barking. After checking the exterior of his home and finding nothing, the man then returned to his bedroom. He then reportedly heard glass break. He went back out into the hallway and came face to face with the alleged armed robber. Captain Mike Ireland said the homeowner indicated the suspect approached him in a threatening manner. The suspect had cuts on his hands and advised the homeowner that he was running from police. He grabbed a nearby shotgun, the homeowner did, yelled out for help. His father apparently heard that cry for help, came out of his room with a handgun, firing a shot towards McDonald and striking him in his chest. According to police, the men immediately called 911 to report the home invasion and shooting. There was a woman in the home at the time of the incident as well. Captain Ireland says the incident is still under investigation, but right now looks like, again, that was a act of self-defense there in Stockbridge, Georgia. We'll keep our eyes on that story, bring you any details if and when they become available. Our deal of the day today from Tulsa, Oklahoma, News on 6. Suspect in fatal Tulsa crash has long criminal history. Jerry Newman, 24 years of age, led police on a high-speed chase early Wednesday before crashing into another car head-on, killing the driver of that vehicle. And a lot of folks are asking questions now whether or not Jerry Newman should have been behind bars. Turns out he had several arrests in Tulsa County over the years for possession of a stolen vehicle. He was recently released from prison, as a matter of fact, back in February, after being in for just under 2 years. He was currently on probation for 3 separate offenses. For whatever reason, even though he was on probation for an offense and then he'd get arrested and convicted of an offense, still, you know, just give you the minimal sentence. and let you out, back out on probation. Now Mr. Newman is expected to face a long list of charges, including a first-degree murder. It was just before 6 a.m. Wednesday. Newman allegedly stole a truck from a repair shop in Sepulpa, Oklahoma, a suburb of Tulsa. When officers showed up, he then took off, leading them on a chase through Midtown out to Tulsa International Airport. He actually went through a gate and onto the runway at Tulsa International Airport. News on 6 in Tulsa says a trooper had to spin Newman out to keep him from running into a jet that was preparing to take off, putting a lot of lives at risk. Then Newman exits the airport, gets onto a road, Highway 75. At one point, he even does a 180, starts driving the wrong way down Highway 75. Troopers say that's when they backed off because it was too dangerous. Dwight Durant, OHP trooper, said, you know, these pursuits, we recognize how dangerous they are. They're fluid. They changed instantly. It was a mile later. Newman still going the wrong way down Highway 75, hits another car head on. The driver of that vehicle, 23-year-old William Bruckman, instantly killed. Bruckman was on his way to work, father of three. Newman was able to run away from the crash. Somehow, police ended up tracking him down by pinging his cell phone. They eventually found him at a home in East Tulsa where troopers arrested him. Police also took two women into custody for questioning. They say it's possible that they helped Newman by giving him a ride. The company that Mr. Bruckman worked for, Containment Solutions, said that William was a valued member of our company. He'll be truly missed by everybody that knew him. Our hearts and prayers are with Mrs. Bruckman and her family. There is a GoFundMe that's been set up by William Bruckman's cousin to help share in the funeral expenses for this 23-year-old's family left behind. Meantime, the 24-year-old suspect being held in the Tulsa County Jail, first-degree murder, eluding, larceny, possession of a stolen vehicle, leaving the scene of a fatal crash and causing an accident which resulted in a death. And Jerry Newman, there in Tulsa, Oklahoma, he is today's deal of the day. Looking at some of the comments, what a fiasco. Our courts are supposed to protect us from people like this. When are we going to start fully enforcing sentencing laws? Let me guess, now that he's caught, one of our Tulsa judges will allow him bail to disappear forever. Yeah, a lot of folks upset about the fact that this guy had a lengthy criminal history, out on probation right now for, again, three separate charges, and none of that seems to matter. Our good guy of the day from the Hartford Courant in Hartford, Connecticut. Off-duty state trooper had a rather unusual occurrence on Tuesday night. An OnStar employee actually alerted state police to a woman in active labor. Yeah, the auto navigation and security system company worker at first thought the woman was on the side of the highway, then realized that she was in a nearby commuter lot. So they're trying to direct police to this woman who's having a baby, but they think she's in one location. Turns out she's in another location. There was an off-duty trooper who just happened to be driving in the area. He heard the police radio transmissions. He was the one who actually found the woman who was in labor. State police said that the he cared for her, assisted with the birth process until on-duty troopers and medics arrived shortly before 7:30 p.m. The baby born there in the parking lot at exit 22 of Route 2 there in Lebanon, Connecticut. And that off-duty state trooper in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, and is today's good guy of the day. Now, we've got a couple of stories to talk about here. I mentioned last hour this DA report on the terror attack in San Bernardino. The San Jose Mercury News out with a story talking about the bravery of these first responders on display in this DA's report. It's a 55-page interoffice memo from the San Bernardino County district attorney's office. And it lays out, according to the Mercury News, exactly how law enforcement officers from multiple agencies responded to the Inland Regional Center within minutes of the attack and killed the attackers in a massive gunfight several hours later nearby. Hal Hauser is a survivor of that attack. Shortly after the shooting began, he and others escaped to a room. They held the door shut against the attacker. When the Mercury News asked him for a response to this, a DH report, he said, "I don't think I need to discuss whether police were justified in shooting the attacker or not." No, I haven't heard anybody actually raise that objection. It is California, so it could happen, but I haven't heard anybody raise that objection. What I really thought was interesting, San Jose Mercury News just kind of mentions this as an aside. They say, as a gun owner who stepped up his target practice after surviving the attack, Hal Hauser said what surprised him most was that only 10% of the officers' rounds hit the terrorists, which he attributed to pounding adrenaline in a survival situation. He said, you know, those guys were amped up when they heard shots fired at their fellow officers. He said that drove home how much practice people should have in order to stop an assailant such as a home intruder. And again, what are anti-gun activists trying to do? Trying to prevent that training from taking place, trying to prevent people from going to the range and getting that experience and getting that practice. Because supposedly keeping people from that education and training is what the quote-unquote gun safety activists do. The Mercury News says that two officers were injured by the gunfire from the terrorist suspects, others pinned down behind vehicles. Julie Swan Paez, who is a survivor, shot twice in the main conference room there at the Inland Regional Center, said the newest things that she learned about the report, the extent of the individual officers' roles, and the timeline of the officers' response, pursuit, and gunfight. She was also surprised, she said, at how many officers responded. She said, after reading it, it was evident that there were really a lot of good breaks that went our way in order to find these suspects so quickly. Yeah, well, and again, sometimes that's what it takes, lucky breaks. But, you know, we're looking at the attack in Manchester right now and still looking for some of those lucky breaks. Instead, what we're seeing in Manchester sounds like are a lot of missed opportunities to maybe have prevented that attack in the first place. Meanwhile, our friend Gary sent me an email just a couple of minutes ago, a story out of California today, or yesterday rather, a Pelican State Prison, Pelican Bay State Prison. Huge brawl there in the prison in California yesterday. Guards in three gun towers firing 19 shots in order to stop large groups of prisoners from attacking other correctional officers on Wednesday. Is this a, was this a, Cameron, did we miss the breaking news on this yesterday when this happened?
No. I didn't see that one.
I didn't see that one either. That seems to me like that would be a kind of a breaking news situation there. Eight guards treated at hospitals and released. One of them is going to have shoulder surgery. All eight had facial injuries, bumps, bruises, and contusions, according to Terry Thornton, spokeswoman for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. She said they just ran towards the incident from several areas of the yard and just rushed the officers. They overwhelmed them. Overwhelmed is the word I heard again and again. That is amazing. The guards apparently had been using pepper spray and batons to break up a fistfight between two inmates when they were swarmed by other felons in an exercise yard teeming, they say, with several hundred high-security inmates. Five of the seven injured inmates suffered gunshot wounds at the prison. Four were admitted to the hospital, including one who was airlifted to a different hospital for a higher level of care. Three discharged back to the prison. Investigators right now trying to determine if the widespread attack was planned. Two inmate-made weapons found at the scene. The Department of Corrections spokesperson said they appear to be makeshift weapons that inmates seized during the fight. Premeditated or not, the mass attack was unusual. 97 inmates housed in disciplinary housing units after the assault because they are believed to have participated. Thornton's been with the DOC for 20 years. She says, I can't recall an incident like this where so many inmates just swarmed our staff like that. I really can't. She said, believe it or not, staff assaults of varying degrees happen every day, but sometimes it's just someone being resistant. Not this time. Nicole Gomez, spokeswoman for the California Correctional Peace Officers Association, said they're concerned that attacks like this might become more common. She said, we're concerned that this type of activity will increase as the state continues to ignore negative inmate behavior for the sake of monetary savings. Again, talking about what's been going on in California for the past couple of years after the U.S. Supreme Court told the state, you got to do something. You got too many inmates. You got not enough medical beds in your prisons. You got to do something. You either got to build more space. You got to reduce the number of inmates. California decided to reduce the number of inmates. They'll shuffle some of these inmates off to the county jails. Others will get released early. Yahoo News says that California has sharply reduced its prison population in recent years. New regulations stemming from another voter-approved initiative are intended to reward inmates for good behavior by reducing their prison sentences. Thornton said inmates still punished if they misbehave, said, quote, yes, we're trying to improve inmates' lives by providing rehabilitative programs, but to say that we ignore negative behavior, that's absurd. Well, it would appear that there are some prison guards who feel differently in California. All right, we're going to step away for just a moment or two when we come back. Dan Bongino at Conservative Review, whistleblower, says the Obama administration knew that gang members were part of this surge in illegal immigration and apparently not really worthy of discussion, not really worthy of concern for the administration. We'll talk about it with Dan Bongino right after this quick timeout. So stick around. There's a lot more Cam and Company still to come.
Talking with Lieutenant Colonel Robert Ledee from the Armor for Troops Foundation. What is Armor for Troops all about? I mean, it sounds like it might be kind of self-explanatory, right?
We started this in 2005. We realized there was a lot of shortage of equipment overseas, so we started the foundation. We provide anti-ballistic eyewear, Under Armour, multifunction tools, knee pads, elbow pads, antibacterial clothing. You know, you don't, Marines and the whole military in the war zone don't shower for 2 or 3 weeks. At that point, only your mother will love you. But we provide equipment. We're doing boots, boot pads. We started doing some vests, but they got so expensive we couldn't do it anymore.
Wow, that's still an amazing amount of material that you all are able to supply free of charge to these members of the military.
The boxes we were standing in had a retail of $750 of all the stuff we put in it. In addition to all the equipment, we also put in batteries, toothpaste, toothbrush, disposable shavers, deodorant, clear eyes, lip thing. We had face wipes, hand wipes, foot powder. So we put a big box together.
That is fantastic. And this is all volunteer driven?
Yes, it is. We have zero salaries. Everybody is a volunteer, have been for over 10 years, and no one gets paid anything here.
And how many people have you been able to help since 2005?
Well, we sent out over 46,000 pairs of eyewear alone. So you got to say we've helped over 46,000 people. Doesn't count the thousands of Under Armour and multifunction tools, et cetera.
That is incredible. Was there anything like this when you were active duty?
No. And I did 31 years in the Marine Corps. So because of what was happening, especially going to a war zone, I remember what Secretary Rumsfeld said. You go to war with what you have, not with what you want. So we started figuring out that there was a shortage of things. We were going to do something that no one else has done. The military did offer equipment. We just gave them better, great equipment.
Very pleased to have with us on set here, Johnny Joey Jones. You've got a fascinating story in your own right. You're a former bomb tech, right?
Yeah, EOD, Marine Corps.
And now you're working with Zach Brown.
I am, yeah. I work for the country music guy. We call him the knife maker that plays music, but Zach Brown.
And that's why you're out here at SHOT Show?
It is, yeah. Long story short, we have a camp for kids with autism that suffer from the autism spectrum. And one of the ways we create revenue for that camp, which is Zach's prime passion, is also some of his other passions, which is knife making. So we have a knife company called Southern Grind, and we believe we sell really nice knives at a good price, 100% American made, and all the proceeds go back to our camp. So
you brought a couple of the knives with you, right?
I did, yeah. These are our flagship knives. We have a folder, and this one's called the Bad Monkey, and it's got an Emerson Wave patent on it. Zach is good friends with Ernest, and so this is something that they worked together on a little bit. And then our flagship fixed blade is called our Jackal, and all of our fixed blades are cut originally through water jet from old sawmill blades. And I don't know all the tolerances, but I know they're very precise.
So this is an old sawmill blade?
Yeah. Isn't that neat?
How cool is that?
Well, if you get to know Zach, you listen to his music, you come visit us in Peachtree City, that fits in his culture, you know. Just the idea of being communal, you know, of a community or of a culture and not just a product you throw out there. It's funny, he's on the road all the time, and we don't put a knife out without him making, you know, changes or designing it himself, so it turns into a lengthy process. But when we're done, it's a really amazing product.
You know, and again, the proceeds from these knives go to that camp,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and we stole a leathersmith from Louis Vuitton, so we have a leather company, and we're going to do some holsters and knife sheaths. I've got a backpack over here. We did a project with Benelli where we did some slings and sheaths that match. And
wow.
So we're working in this industry because it's such an amazing industry.
Thanks so much for being a part of this edition of Cam and Company. We've got Quinn Cox with Students for Concealed Carry coming up in just a little bit right now. From Conservative Review, very pleased to have with us. Dan Bongino is with us. Dan, how are you, sir?
Good. You got me at just the right time. I was like getting ready to blow my nose. And I'm like, he's coming right to me. You don't want that on camera.
Yeah, right to you. Listen, we can give you 10 seconds if you need to go ahead and take care of that. But you're fine. You sound fine.
Good.
Live radio, right? You got to love it. Stephen Danan of the Washington Times has the story today, quoting Senator Ron Johnson. It's so nice, by the way, Dan, to actually have an on-the-record source for an allegation, right, as opposed to the unnamed sources here. But Senator Ron Johnson, chairman of the Senate Homeland Security Committee, says that a whistleblower turned over Customs and Border Protection documents from 2014 detailing 16 people who were caught crossing the border. Senator Johnson says they apprehended them. They knew that they were MS-13 gang members, and they processed and dispersed them into our communities. These were part of the surge of the unaccompanied alien children. Admitted MS-13 gang members, Dan, and that was not an impediment to entry into this country.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sadly, tragically, horrifically not surprised. I wish I was surprised, but this is the insanity we have to deal with every day. You know, I brought up this point this morning where I said, you know, we're at the point right now, sadly, where you have one party that's broken, all right? I mean, we all get that. The Republican Party's broken. It is. You have conservatives. We have libertarians. We have populists within it. I mean, we're broken. We don't have a unified message right now, sadly. But you have another party that is actively committed to the destruction of America. I'll take the broken party any day of the week and twice on Sunday. It's not just that liberals right now are fighting for things like this dispersing MS-13 gang members throughout our community that are just not going to help people. It's that they're actively fighting for an agenda that's going to actively and actually get people hurt or potentially killed. It's disgusting. This is a broken, horrible party. I can't encourage your listeners in strong enough terms to get a run from these people. Don't walk. They're that dangerous.
You know, Senator Claire McCaskill is the ranking Democrat on the committee, according to the Washington Times, said she wants to get rid of gangs, but criticized the release of the whistleblower documents, saying that it may have hurt active investigations or otherwise dented efforts to get the gang members out of the country. Now, boy, you want to talk about some political doublespeak, Dan. They didn't have to let these gang members into the country, Right? And so now, well, geez, you know, if we let these documents out, we're concerned that maybe it's going to, you know, impede the efforts to get them out. Well, that's the issue. They shouldn't have been let in the first place if they're admitted gang members belonging to MS-13, a gang which, by the way, you know, all across the country, but even in the D.C. area, is responsible for a growing number of heinous crimes.
Yeah, Claire McCaskill all of a sudden cares about information integrity within the government. This is the keep in mind, the same senator who couldn't care any less about the leak of the Trump tax returns. Intel leaks every day, which are putting the United States in danger in order to advance the nonsensical Trump-Russia narrative. But now, right, now Claire McCaskill cares because of the leak. And by the way, this was a whistleblower. It wasn't even a leak. Of gang members' names might jeopardize getting them out of the country, like she really cares about getting them out of the country. I mean, this is just nonsense. I mean, the Democrats have used immigration as a ploy to get votes for years. They don't care about immigrants. I mean, listen, this has been proven over and over. There are Republicans who have put poison pill amendments in immigration bills where they said, tell you what, we'll give you whatever you want on immigration, but the people who come in here illegally just can't vote. And the Democrats say no, because they don't want people to have a better life in the United States. They just want the votes. This is all a scam. I hope you guys understand that. This whole thing is a scam, and people need to call them out for it.
Talking again with Dan Bongino from Conservative Review. And you know, Dan, I mean, you talk about the politics being played here. And again, when you can't get to that point, right, of, okay, look, I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. I don't care. But when you get to that point of, look, we've got government employees who are really bothered by this, and they came forward and they said, look, this shouldn't have happened, and it's happening. And your response is to not say, dang, you know what, that is a real problem. But your response is to instead, I don't know if we should be talking about this. You know, look, I want to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. I want to believe the best in people. I do. But at that point, you're either letting your ideology, you're letting your politics, you're letting something get in the way of common sense. And again, I don't care where you stand on the political spectrum. If the job of the Customs and Border Patrol, which is to keep this nation safe, to interdict those threats at the border, if they are seeing these threats, recognizing these threats, if these threats are admitting they're threats and then there's no consequence, that's a broken system, right? So if you're Claire McCaskill, what's your answer? If you're Ron Johnson, what's your answer? But you have people, as you say, who aren't even willing to recognize that this is a problem.
Yeah, Cam, you just nailed it. And I saw another story today about Denver and on the same immigration line, where the city of Denver is now letting domestic abusers out of jail in under a year, as long as they haven't beaten their spouse. I'm not kidding. If they haven't been convicted three times, because if they spend more than a year in jail, they can be deported. I mean, that's not a story from The Onion. I'm not making that up. It's up at Hot Air right now. It's on my Facebook page. You want to read the story yourself. This is insanity. And you know what, Cam? We call our own people out when they do really dumb stuff. You have any doubts about that? There are people who disagree with Trump strongly on trade who are Republicans. They don't care that he's a Republican. They're like, hey, I don't think you're right on that. There are people who called him out on the budget about the Planned Parenthood thing. There are people who call out Trump and Republicans all the time. The whole Tea Party movement was an effort to combat weak Republicans. I like what you just said, though. Why can't the Democrats do the same thing? Just come out and stand on principle and go, you know what? I'm for a looser immigration policy, but I'm not for this. This is ridiculous. Gang members in the country putting our communities. This is insanity. How do we get to the bottom of this and get these guys out? But you're right. They will never do it, because when your priorities are politics first and America 15th, that's the kind of stupid comments you get from Democrats.
Dan Bongino with Conservative Review on Twitter at dbongino, bongino.com as well. Dan, as always, sir, appreciate your time. Thank you very much for coming on the show. I hope we get a chance to do this again soon.
Yeah, brother, anytime. Talk to you soon.
All right, man. We'll talk to you soon. Dan Bongino with us here on Cam and Company. Again, Quinn Cox going to join us a little bit later on in the program as well, from Students for Concealed Carry at UT Austin on, again, it's being called a study. It's not. It's a dissertation for a grad student who decided to look at, quote-unquote, Metropolitan University. maybe the University of Houston, and decided to talk to a dozen or so professors about their experience with concealed carry, and from there extrapolate what effect concealed carry or campus carry is having on all campuses, on all professors, on all students there across the state of Texas. So we'll talk with Quinn Cox about that coming up a little bit later on in the program. In the meantime, we are also watching what's going on in state houses around the country. In Michigan, got a pro-gun bill that is on its way to the full Senate. Senate Judiciary Committee passing out Senate Bill 366, similar legislation to what we have seen in a couple of other states like Nevada. This would establish a provisional concealed carry permit for Michiganders who are between the ages of 18 and 20. Those who can serve in the military, they can work in law enforcement, they could hold public office, but they could not legally obtain a concealed carry license. This would, again, establish a provisional concealed carry permit for those Michigan residents between the ages of 18 and 20, passing out of the Senate Judiciary Committee, now headed in Michigan to the full Senate, and we'll continue following that legislation there in Michigan. Meanwhile, in Nebraska. So we've been talking about this preemption bill in Nebraska for the past couple of months. Unfortunately, we are halfway through the session, and right now it looks like no movement. This is a two-year session, so the Nebraska legislature has adjourned until January. All of the bills carry over from where they left off, so we don't have to start from scratch. That's the good news. It's LB 68. That's the preemption bill. Passed the first round of floor debate. It's on a select file for the second round. And hopefully when lawmakers reconvene there in Nebraska in January, we can get this bill rolling again. Senator Mike Hilgers has said that I'm committed to passing LB 68. I will continue to fight for law-abiding gun owners in Nebraska. He says, I look forward to continuing to work towards a common-sense solution to Nebraska's confusing patchwork of firearm laws. You've got really just a couple of jurisdictions in the state of Nebraska that are really the issue here, Omaha and Lincoln, although there may be some other smaller communities across the state that have their own local ordinances. But that's really the issue. Again, you don't know when you're driving from town to town across the state of Nebraska how the laws may vary. Again, gun control activists, they're happy with that. That's again, not a bug. It's a feature. The more confusing the laws are, the better if you're an anti-gun advocate, because the more confusing the laws are, the more likely it is that someone's going to say, you know what, forget it. I don't even understand what these laws are. It's not worth my trouble. And anything that they can do, again, to bring down legal gun ownership, they are in favor of. Now, there are a couple of other bills in Nebraska as well that are still alive. LB 321 would permit lawful possession of a firearm on college or university grounds for members of all firearms-related teams, not just rifle teams. One would think that, again, would be a common-sense measure. Let's hope that it could be a common-sense measure there in Nebraska. Also, LB 558 amends the definition of knife. And expands the types and lengths of knives that may be carried in public. Also, LB 666 would provide that a person cannot commit the offense of carrying a concealed weapon if the firearm is unloaded and stored in a case defined as a hard-sided or soft-sided box, container, or receptacle designed for the purpose of storing a firearm. I'm kind of shocked that a person who's carrying an unloaded firearm in a hard-sided or soft-sided box, container, or receptacle designed for the purpose of storing a firearm could be charged with carrying a concealed weapon to begin with. But apparently that is the case in Nebraska, so hopefully we can get that common-sense revision passed. But it's, again, it's going to take a few months now because the legislative session in Nebraska out until January. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk with Quinn Cox with Students for Concealed Carry at UT Austin, the president of Students for Concealed Carry at UT Austin, on this new dissertation by a student taking a look at the effects of campus carry on at least a dozen professors there in the Lone Star State. Stick around. There's more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Outside Washington, D.C. at the Congressional Shootout, here is Chris Cox, head of the NRA's Institute for Legislative Action. Good to see you, Chris.
It's great to be out here.
What do you feel like here in Maryland? I know we're here at a trap and ski club, but we're in the state of Maryland. You know, for people who don't know around the country, people think of California, they think of New York. Maryland is pretty up there, too.
It is. It's one of the most challenging states, and it's one of the most frustrating states. We've talked about the Fourth Circuit and the total debacle of the court case there. But this is part of what we have to deal with, and part of what we do. We can sit back and be frustrated and complain about it, or we can move forward with an agenda to try to rectify and try to fix these problems. We were just talking to our friend Congressman Richard Hudson, who's carrying the House a right to carry reciprocity bill. So there's a lot of things that can be done outside of the state of Maryland and how they approach the Second Amendment. But ultimately, this is part of what we do every day.
You know, you talked, there's here lots of members of Congress, but we also talk about President Trump's in the White House, Ryan Zinke's Interior Secretary, a lot of good people in with this issue when it comes to hunting, shooting, fishing. But there's also people who will be complacent. Oh, the salad days. You know, how do you keep the message that, listen, you've got to still keep fighting?
Well, the work didn't stop on November 8th. It was a great election, no question about it. But something else happened on November 8th, or on November 9th, our opponents woke up, and they were less than pleased with President Trump, violently so in some cities. And you've seen a commitment and an energy on their side. You're seeing it in this Georgia 6 special election. I was just out in Montana this past week with Donald Trump Jr. Campaigning for Gianforte, and you're seeing an energy and a fundraising and an operation on the other side that we can't sit back and be apathetic over. All of these, we have to bring the same moral purpose and same intensity to all of these legislative fights that we brought to the elections last year. If we do that and we stay engaged, then we prove that we can shock the world and change the course of history. But if we sit back and don't engage further, then this is going to be a short-term window for us.
When you talk about violence, I saw a story yesterday in North Dakota. These town halls, these members of Congress, they go back, and these town halls are really nasty. And there was one yesterday in North Dakota. Some guy grabbed the congressman's collar, put dollars in it. You know, they're trying to pay him off. You've been in this. You know the game. You've been in this town a long time. You know how this all works. But have you seen... has it gotten so bad that we're past the point of no return when it comes to political civility?
Well, you hope not. But you saw President Obama had an opportunity to pull this country together on so many different levels, and all he did was further divide the country. You've seen a mainstream media that's not interested in reporting, you know, a civil dialogue, civil disagreements. They're interested in trying to undermine this president, certainly trying to undermine the National Rifle Association. So there's nothing really new about politics sometimes being personal and ugly, but the level has never been this high. And so the hope is that, you know, we can have an intellectually honest debate of ideas. But the problem is, when we have an intellectually honest debate of ideas, we always win. Honestly, I mean, and so when you don't have the facts on your side, you go with emotion. And when the only emotion that works is one of violence and outrage, then, you know, and the media will report on it day by day, then that's what they go with. And it's unfortunate, but it's part of the world that we have to live in and deal with.
This event is run by the Congressional Sportsman Foundation. You know, they talk a lot about hunting and fishing and angling. Talk about the NRA's role when it comes to hunting. Some people think the NRA just thinks only about the gun, Second Amendment. Talk about the hunting aspect.
Sure. I mean, the National Rifle Association, whether it's in courtrooms, state legislatures, in the international arena, and certainly in Washington, D.C., we're the tip of the spear on all of these issues, whether it's our hunting heritage or our Second Amendment freedom. So this is a great group. Congressional Sportsman's Caucus was started in 1988, 1989. It's the largest caucus in Congress, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily the most successful caucus in Congress. We've had a frustrating run for the last 7 or 8 years with the lack of the ability to pass a meaningful sportsman's package of, you know, dealing with land access issues, dealing with closures, dealing with range development, dealing with, you know, carrying on Army Corps lands, dealing with the Hearing Protection Act, a lot of things that are really no-brainers when it comes to providing, you know, better public policies that relates to sportsmen and hunters out there. And that's what we're up there doing. And, you know, we'll take all the help we can get, certainly. But it's ultimately up to the people, you know, NRA members and sportsmen and hunters across the country to make sure that our priorities become Congress's priorities. They're not just going to happen. As we've talked before, it's not like the day after the election, Congress said, hey, let's go expand self-defense. Let's go deal with sportsmen's access issues. No, it's up to us to do that work. And as you mentioned, apathy can be a problem, but the energy and the commitment that gun owners and NRA members brought to the elections last year, if we carry that out and maintain that level of enthusiasm, I think we have a window to really get some great things done.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Quinn Cox is the president of Students for Concealed Carry at UT Austin, joins us now to talk about this new dissertation. Quinn, how are you today?
Pretty good. How are you, Cam? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a real pleasure. Lindsay Ellis at the Houston Chronicle with this story on a quote-unquote study. Now, I'm not going to call it a study. I'm going to call it a dissertation because that's what it was. Nathaniel Craddett, who recently earned his doctorate in higher adult and lifelong education at Michigan State University, interviewed about a dozen professors over 3 weeks at a campus he dubbed a Metropolitan University in Texas for his dissertation, which is all about campus carry. And Quinn, you're going to be shocked to learn that he found some professors who are concerned about campus carry.
Yes, sir. Yeah, that's quite the issue at UT. A lot of them, there's a lot of misinformation, and a lot of the professors as well as the student body are misinformed. A lot of them think and they believe that it is open carry on campus when it is, in fact, concealed carry on campus. I actually had a professor this semester during our syllabus day, first day of school. There's a little part of the syllabus that explains about campus carry, and he described it as open carry, and I had to correct him. I said, no, sir, it's concealed carry. Just in general, I think that you can kind of get the gist of, how a lot of them are misinformed just with that. So, yeah, definitely a lot of them are concerned, and in my opinion, and, there's not a whole lot of evidence for that concern out there.
Well, I think you're right about that, Quinn. But I also think that, too, according to this dissertation, so you talk to a dozen professors at a university that has about 25,000 students. So you're talking about a very small number of professors that are talked to. According to the Houston Chronicle, of these 12 professors, one reported skirting a meeting with a, quote, combative student out of fear of personal safety. Another moved office hours to a public space to avoid private conversations with any student who may be carrying. And a third said that she needed to be, quote, a little more cautious when she discussed Sigmund Freud and femininity in the classroom. Why she felt that, we don't really know. So now this student talked to 12 professors. Apparently three of them had concerns, and those were the concerns, Quinn. So, honestly, I got to tell you, I think that there's some hype to this headline in the Houston Chronicle. Three professors say, I feel a little uneasy. Haven't had anything happen, but I'm a little cautious.
Yeah, certainly. There's no evidence since the implementation of campus carry since August 1st of last year in the state of Texas. There has only been one incident involving campus carry, and Students for Concealed Carry has been upfront about that. It was accidental discharge in a dorm at Tarleton State University. I believe it was September of last year. But that is the only incident that has ever happened to that has been related to campus carry in since its implementation. And there were no injuries or anything like that. It was just carelessness on the part of the owner. And I, on that article, I can't remember if it's that one or another one, but they cited two more instances where there was one where an alumnus of University of Houston committed suicide at a on-campus hotel, which is very unfortunate, but it has absolutely nothing to do with campus carry, even though they did cite it as that in one of the articles. And there was also a shooting, I believe it was in Texas Tech, where it was on a road near the university. And so they cited those three incidents. Only one of them was related to campus carry, and it resulted in no no injuries and just minimal damage to a dorm floor, essentially. So there is no real evidence for, you know, massive amounts of concern that these professors are having.
Well, and buried in this story, I think it's paragraph 12 in this story, quote, students say that they largely had moved on to other issues and did not feel intimidated in the classroom. To me, that's more of a headline, Quinn, I'll be honest with you, because we've heard that too, that for students across the state of Texas, this has gone from being a huge issue at the beginning of the school year to a non-issue now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could see back in August when with the whole, people displaying dildos in the middle of campus and things of that nature, and there was just so much anger over this piece of legislation. And then now we're, you know, almost a year into the whole policy and nothing really has happened of note. And so, to be honest, there's this sort of, I want to say sort of apathy, amongst the student body. They kind of come to accept it. A few of my friends who were so vehemently against campus carry in August are now starting to see how it really hasn't affected their life that much on campus. And they're kind of apathetic to it now. They're not for it. They're not against it. And so, I think that was the point of the legislation, was that if you're not required to carry on campus by any means, but if you would like to and you should have the right to be able to do so, then you should be able to, carry on campus and like you would anywhere else, like a movie theater or, you know, park, anything like that. Even the state capitol here in Texas, you can carry inside and watch that Texas House of Representatives and the Senate, you know, debate bills on the floor. And so I think that is generally the goal, is that if you would like to carry on campus, it's more about personal protection. You can protect yourself on campus. And that was essentially the goal of the bill.
I'm curious, Quinn. I mean, you are the head of Students for Concealed Carry there at UT Austin. How has the mission of Students for Concealed Carry changed now that campus carry is the law in Texas?
So essentially the mission is to, because since this bill was, passed very quickly through, it was passed quickly through the session, a couple of years back, there were some loopholes in it. And what essentially happens is that professors are allowed to, exclude students, from all going to office hours, by putting up, you know, not the official 30.06 sign, which is the, prohibition of concealed carry, in any place of business. They have to put it in writing in the syllabus or something. And that effectively makes their office a gun-free zone. I've heard of some professors, that have been, having students leave their backpacks outside of the classroom, which essentially if they're carrying, that's having them break the law because the backpack is leaving their line of sight. And it also raises security concerns where you're just leaving your backpack out of sight and, you know, you've got very valuable laptops, like a $2,000 Mac in there, and they could take that. And so essentially our goal, our legislative goal, is to, you know, clean things up and fix some of these loopholes. Since we are the flagship university of the state of Texas and we are so close to the Capitol, we're definitely going to try to influence that and, you know, see what we can do to fix these loopholes and make this bill a little bit better.
Are you still showing or seeing a lot of interest from students? I mean, now that this is the law of the land, you're not fighting for this right, but are you still having students sign up, join Students for Concealed Carry on campus?
Yeah, absolutely. We have quite a few members who haven't even shot a gun before, but are very interested in, you know, their personal safety, their personal protection. We are planning this next semester with a local gun shop. We're planning a learning class where you go in and it's the same as if you would with the state of Texas to get your certification. We're just going to have a large one on campus and everything. It's just the classroom version of it. Obviously, we have to go to a gun range to do the target practice and everything like that the state requires. But we're planning on stuff like that. And so basically, since the law is already the law of the land, our goal is to, one, clean up the bill and stuff like that and on the legislative side, and two, just get people, educate people about the law, address that misinformation I referred to earlier, as well as, you know, educate people on, you know, their rights and, you know, what they can and can't do, stuff like that. And so basically it's just a legislative and educational goal at this point.
Well, Quinn, listen, I do appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It is good talking with you today, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk again later in the year, maybe back in the fall when students return to class.
Yes, sir. Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me on, Cam.
Absolutely. Quinn Cox, president of Students for Concealed Carry there at UT Austin. And, you know, even though a lot of colleges, we've had graduation, classes are over for the year, still seeing some reports of crime on campus. Richmond, Virginia, VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University. Person robbed Thursday afternoon on the campus there in Richmond by a gunman who said, "Give me everything." Broad daylight, right there in the campus, downtown Richmond. Alert sent by VCU police around 1 p.m. said the robbery had occurred about 12:45 in the afternoon. Man with a gun approached the victim, demanded, "Give me everything." Gunman then went into the victim's pockets, removed belongings. Richmond police leading the investigation, VCU police said in its statement to the community. But they have increased patrols in the area. So there you go. You're safe. You also had three football players at the University of Illinois booted off of the football team, charged with home invasion and robbery. That was yesterday when the players got the boot. There was a attempted robbery near Brooklyn College in New York earlier this week. Also at the Ohio State University, yet another robbery right near campus. Several robberies taking place near or on the Ohio State University. This one, latest one, Thursday, just before 3 o'clock in the morning. A man claims held at gunpoint, forced to hand over an iPhone, an Apple Watch, and $170 cash. So, you know, again, the idea that our college campuses are crime-free is absurd. But now with a school year, you know, under the belt there in Texas, you've been able to look and see what has happened with campus carry. And the fact of the matter is nothing has happened with campus carry. And isn't it fascinating, again, that the headline in the Houston Chronicle isn't "Students don't see campus carry as a big deal." No, instead it's, "Oh, this new study shows that professors are freaked out by campus carry." Again, a study of 12 professors, three of whom said, "You know, I'm not meeting in my office." One said they're not meeting in their office. One said, "Yeah, you know, I rescheduled this meeting with a student because I was afraid there would be combative." And then one professor said, "You know, when I was teaching Freud and feminism, I thought, maybe I need to change the way I'm thinking and teaching this class." Now, first of all, I don't think you need to do that, honestly. What I would ask all of those, every one of those three professors, did you feel this way last year? That student that you were reluctant to meet with, what happened when you had a student before campus carry that you maybe were reluctant to meet with? Maybe you thought they were going to be combative. What did you do then? Now, you wouldn't be concerned about a concealed carry holder, a legal law-abiding gun owner coming into onto the campus in violation of the state law and going to your office. So what were you concerned about then? Changing the way that you're teaching a course because, what, there might be a concealed carry holder there who would get upset about the way you're teaching and they would whip out their firearm. Well, last year, when campus carry wasn't the law, did you worry about a student getting angry or aggressive, breaking the law in your classroom, assaulting you or a student because they disagree with the way things were being taught? Did you worry about that before people who are legally allowed to own and carry firearms could legally carry firearms on campus? If the concern, why is the concern the possibility of a concealed carry holder as opposed to the concern over your personal safety and maybe the concern over the mental health of students more generally? I don't get why campus carry has changed things for these professors. When we're talking about a body of people in the state of Texas, statistically speaking, more law-abiding than the general population. In Florida, again, we know more law-abiding than police officers per capita. So what is it about this? And I would say it's an unreasonable fear that these professors have, that they have gotten freaked out by the media coverage of campus carry. And they're at an institution of higher learning where you're supposed to learn to think critically. I don't think we're seeing a lot of critical thinking going on here. Because I think if these professors were to think critically about what has changed, who is legally carrying, if they would simply remember that, oh, yeah, you know what, every time I'm off campus, yeah, there's probably a concealed carry holder around. I bet that would do wonders to alleviate those unreasonable fears. But I don't know that these professors are thinking like that. Well, clearly not. But now we've got a new study, quote unquote, to tell us what these professors are thinking. All right, we are almost out of time here on this edition of Cam and Company, but we are hard at work already on tomorrow's program. Tony Katz from WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana, will join us. Also, our friend Dennis Santiago from Dennis Talks Guns out in California will join us on the program. And Ed Morrissey from Hot Air, he'll be with us as well. And we'll have more of the day's top stories. It's all coming up again tomorrow, Friday. Yes, we're not taking off early for Memorial Day. We will be here live, 2 p.m. Eastern on NRA TV. Also, midnight Eastern, 9 Pacific, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Thanks again for being a part of today's program. We will see you soon. In the meantime, be safe, have fun, and thanks for tuning in.